Bonsoir, bienvenue au colloque Stratégie pour le journalisme. Welcome to this Journalism Strategies Conference. I'm Colette Brin, Journalism Professor at Université Laval. Je vais vous parler un petit peu de... juste dire quelques mots sur les objectifs de cette conférence avant de présenter notre premier débat. This is a collective initiative about discussing about what journalism is in a democracy and what it should be and how what could we really do about it. And it's I think it's a somewhat original and ambitious project. Bien sûr, c'est pas la première fois qu'un colloque a lieu sur le journalisme. Il semble même en ce moment que c'est un peu la mode de tenir des colloques sur l'avenir du journalisme. Mais nous croyons que celui-ci est très original par sa forme, par la variété, la diversité des participants. Et par l'audace, je pense, des questions qu'il pose. So it's a somewhat original, ambitious project, not only because of the nature and the diversity of participants involved, but also because of the questions that we're asking and the proposals that we want to put forward at the end of this conference. And we hope you will all be a part of those proposals. Donc, nous allons avoir la traduction simultanée tout au long de la séance ce soir et pendant tout au long, en fait, des séances publiques. This is our first public event tonight, and we will have simultaneous translation tonight and tomorrow evening as well. I would like to direct you to the conference guide for the list of sponsors. Les commanditaires sont dans le programme. Et donc, sans plus tarder, je vais vous présenter nos deux premiers panélistes, ou enfin notre premier échange entre deux collègues que je connais bien. Monsieur Marc Raboy, donc Dr. Marc Raboy is Beaverbrook Chair in Ethics, Media and Communication and Director of Media at McGill. Et Florian Sauvageau, mon collègue de l'Université Laval, récemment nommé professeur émérite, et fondateur et président, du Centre d'études sur les médias, co-auteur du rapport sur la politique, bon là je ne l'ai pas en français devant les yeux, mais sur le groupe de travail sur la politique en radiodiffusion.
La politique de la radiodiffusion.
Oui, c'est ça. So I guess I should translate that. Florian Sauvageau is founder and president of the Centre d'études sur les médias, co-author of the 1986 report of the Task Force on Broadcasting Policy, and professor emeritus, I never know how to say that in English, at the Université Laval. And they will be opening the discussion for us on this important issue. Merci.
Merci. Merci de nous avoir invités. Enfin, merci de m'avoir invité. Marc pourra vous remercier lui-même, les organisateurs. Alors, Marc et moi, nous avons décidé d'échanger, c'est-à-dire d'avoir un dialogue, enfin, peut-être ce sera deux monologues, mais on va alterner, et puis on a fait une espèce de continuité. C'est le rodage d'un numéro qu'on compte présenter au fil des mois dans plusieurs salles de spectacle. Alors, la question que pose ce colloque, ou les questions que pose ce colloque, porte sur l'avenir du journalisme et sur l'avenir, et est-ce que la période aussi est propice pour penser à un avenir sur les politiques publiques qui pourraient faire en sorte que le journalisme soit en meilleure santé qu'il ne l'est maintenant. Alors, autant le dire tout de suite, je suis plutôt, si on regarde d'ailleurs le bilan et le passé, je suis plutôt pessimiste sur l'avenir que pourraient avoir les politiques publiques ou l'intervention de l'État en matière de médias et de journalisme. Et je ne répondrai pas à la question personnellement, si Marc veut se risquer, tant mieux pour lui, mais je ne répondrai pas à la question sur l'avenir du journalisme parce que j'ai fait, il y a 3 ans, avec mon ami Jacques Godbout, un film documentaire dont un des objectifs était d'essayer de démontrer que ceux qui ont des réponses sur l'avenir du journalisme, il faut surtout s'en méfier parce que ce sont des fumistes. Alors, ne comptez pas sur moi pour vous dire dans ma boule de cristal ce que sera l'avenir du journalisme. Ce que nous avons choisi de faire dans un premier temps, et c'est moi qui le ferai le premier, c'est d'expliquer très rapidement notre parcours, parce que la conception qu'on a l'un et l'autre, qui ne sont pas si différentes d'ailleurs, en partie, mais on arrive à réconcilier, depuis tant d'années qu'on travaille ensemble, on arrive à réconcilier nos différences. La conception que chacun de nous se fait du journalisme est ancrée dans votre parcours et dans notre parcours personnel. Alors, Colette a eu l'amabilité de dire tout à l'heure que j'étais maintenant un professeur émérite. Alors, quand on est un professeur émérite, c'est qu'on est vieux. Et mon journalisme s'incarne non seulement dans la Révolution tranquille, ça c'est celui de Marc, mais mon journalisme à moi prend ses origines dans ce qu'on a appelé au Québec la grande noirceur. Marc me disait tout à l'heure, je lui ai demandé comment on traduisait la grande noirceur, il m'a dit, ça se traduit pas, il faut dire de Duplessis era. Alors, c'est à cette époque-là que j'ai décidé, je pense inconsciemment, parce que j'étais quand même pas si vieux dans les années 50, j'étais adolescent, c'est à cette époque-là que j'ai décidé de faire du journalisme en voyant à la télévision, hein, vous savez que Radio-Canada, une institution fédérale, a joué un rôle capital dans l'évolution du Québec et dans la formation de l'identité québécoise. Et à cette époque-là, en voyant discourir à la télévision les grands pontifs de l'époque, Gérard Pelletier, devenu ministre, Jean-Louis Gagnon, devenu à la mort d'André Laurendeau, président de la commission d'enquête sur le bilinguisme et le biculturalisme, René Lévesque, devenu non seulement ministre libéral, mais premier ministre d'un gouvernement du Parti québécois, c'est en voyant ces gens-là que j'ai décidé que j'allais faire dans ma vie du journalisme. Et c'est un autre monde. C'est presque l'ancienne époque où les journalistes au Québec allaient tous faire de la politique et leur biographie commençait avocat, journaliste et homme politique. Alors moi, j'ai été avocat, journaliste, mais pas homme politique. Alors, le journalisme de cette époque, c'est celui du maître à penser. C'est pas le journalisme que les jeunes d'aujourd'hui souhaitent quand ils parlent d'une conversation. C'est le journalisme du magistère, le journalisme de Claude Ryan au Devoir qui nous disait quoi penser. C'est ce journalisme-là que j'ai connu, c'est ce journalisme-là, j'ai grandi dans ce journalisme-là, ce qui fait qu'aujourd'hui, on en parlera dans un instant, quand on me dit le journalisme, ce n'est plus un cours magistral, c'est une conversation, vous devez comprendre que j'ai du mal à apprendre à ce que le journalisme devienne une conversation, parce que pour moi, le journalisme s'inscrit dans une autre époque, dans un autre monde, où les journalistes étaient, hélas peut-être, les grands pontifs, chers collègues.
Thank you, Florian. Yeah, well, I'm not quite an emeritus professor yet, but getting there perhaps. And I think it's significant that we are just slightly of different generations, and that may have made a difference. I literally fell in love with journalism at the age of 16 when I entered McGill and discovered the McGill Daily. And those were days when anything seemed possible, and journalism to me was a way of participating in the great events of the time. We believed that a student newspaper was an agent of social change, and I'd like to think that a newspaper or any journalistic platform should see itself as an agent of social change. And looking back, that was perhaps my happiest time as a journalist, and maybe it spoiled me for professional work. Because when I finished school, I was immediately offered two jobs in Toronto, at the Toronto Star and the Toronto Telegram. I went there, but after 6 months in Toronto, I had the opportunity to come back and join the Montreal Star, and I was really eager to get back here because there was so much happening, actually much like today. I was on the education beat, which meant covering student demonstrations, language debates, the education reforms of the Quiet Revolution, and most important, the newspaper at that particular moment saw itself as a progressive force in Quebec, or as a force that could at least cover what was going on in a way that contributed to public understanding. And by the way, the staff of the Montreal Star at the time included some of the great Francophone Quebec journalists of their generation, many of whom were actually unemployable in the French language mainstream press of the late 60s and early 1970s. But something happened almost overnight in 1970 with the outbreak of the October crisis. A chill set into the newsroom. And happily for me, I was also involved in a small alternative magazine called Last Post, which ended up being the journal of record, in English at least, of that period in Quebec. And what I learned during those years and through practicing journalism in a variety of media, although they were all print media, what I learned was the importance of the institutional setting in which journalism is practiced. I mean, one can be a journalist, one can try to do the best one can, but where one is actually doing that ends up being an important part of what one is able to accomplish. And at that time, most newspapers in Canada and Quebec were still family-owned, but those families were part of the elites and could be expected to behave predictably in defense of their interests. The alternative media were often a more important and more interesting source of news and analysis. And what one sees when one actually goes back and looks at the different media at the period is how many innovative ideas, political practices, analyses worked their way into the mainstream from the marginal media of the time. And I think that is very much still the case today. There's one institution which I think bears looking at in a distinct way, and Florian referred to the role of Radio-Canada during the period preceding the Quiet Revolution. I think the public broadcaster, the CBC, has always presented its own particular challenges and opportunities, and I don't know if you're going to talk about that a bit in the next round when you get to dealing with public policies, but let's see. I'll just leave it at that for now.
C'est vrai que Radio-Canada a joué un rôle essentiel et capital, mais il n'y a rien de parfait dans nos sociétés. Alors, Radio-Canada a toujours été... Ces jours-ci, j'écris un article sur le rôle qu'a joué Radio-Canada dans l'évolution du Québec et les batailles qui ont été menées à l'intérieur de Radio-Canada, que Marc, d'ailleurs, dans son livre exceptionnel qui s'appelle « Missed Opportunities » a bien documenté. Ces batailles montrent bien à quel point c'était difficile de réconcilier à la fois la volonté émise par le législateur fédéral dans la législation avec la volonté d'agents de changement des journalistes à l'intérieur de la boîte à Radio-Canada. J'ai connu tous les conflits de Radio-Canada où j'ai travaillé pendant de longues années. De la même manière, d'ailleurs, l'entreprise familiale dont Marc vient de parler, elle a des défauts, bien entendu, mais de grande qualité aussi. Dans ma vie, j'étais un patron de presse, j'étais directeur d'information au Soleil à Québec, directeur de la rédaction, et le président du journal, son bureau était là, dans le journal, accessible. Ensuite, dans les années 70 et les années subséquentes, le Soleil est devenu la propriété de Conrad Black, que ceux qui occupaient les postes de directeur de la rédaction au Soleil ne rencontraient rarement ou jamais. Il y avait là son gestionnaire. Alors, le monde des journaux a changé à ce moment-là. Les politiques publiques, c'est la première question. Qu'est-ce qu'on peut faire avec les politiques publiques? Je pense que tout a été tenté. L'État s'est toujours intéressé aux médias, d'abord pour le contrôler. Avant la télévision publique, il y avait la télévision d'État. Il y a encore, dans bien des sociétés, la télévision d'État. Et la tentation est toujours grande de remplacer la télévision publique par la télévision d'État. Ensuite, l'État a quand même créé, il faut donner à César ce qui lui appartient, d'abord en Angleterre et ensuite dans plusieurs pays, on a suivi le modèle. La télévision publique, indépendante du pouvoir, malgré toutes ses failles. Et ensuite, quand est venue la concentration des médias avec les Conrad Black et avant les autres de ce monde, l'État a commencé à s'inquiéter, ici, chez nous, tant à Québec qu'à Ottawa. À partir de la fin des années 60, début des années 70, il y a eu des rapports nombreux qui se retrouvent sans doute sur des tablettes, jusqu'à celui plus récent à Québec de Dominique Payette que vous entendrez tout à l'heure. Et si on parle de missed opportunities, il y en a eu là des occasions ratées parce qu'il y avait des choses dans ces rapports. Je vais vous citer le rapport que j'aime le plus, c'est le rapport Kent sur les journaux en 1981. Et je vais vous citer la première phrase du rapport Kent, du chapitre premier. La liberté de la presse, j'aime beaucoup citer cette phrase-là. La liberté de la presse n'est pas l'apanage des propriétaires de médias. Elle est un droit du peuple. Elle s'inscrit dans le droit à la libre expression, inséparable du droit à l'information. Tous ces rapports proposaient des choses extrêmement intéressantes. Dans le rapport Kent, par exemple, il y avait une proposition de garantir l'indépendance de la rédaction, parce que de la même manière que Radio-Canada, par exemple, la direction a toujours voulu être indépendante du pouvoir à Ottawa, les journalistes, eux, ont toujours voulu avoir une certaine indépendance dans les salles de rédaction vis-à-vis des directions. Et le rapport Kent, et je vais conclure cette deuxième intervention là-dessus, était aussi un rapport à bien des égards visionnaire. Parce qu'en 1981, le rapport Kent mettait en garde contre ce qui se passe depuis 2 ou 3 ans. C'est-à-dire, le rapport Kent disait qu'il y a un énorme danger pour la presse écrite parce que, avec l'évolution que prendra ce qui ne s'appelait pas encore Internet à l'époque, mais que prendront les nouvelles technologies, les lecteurs délaisseront lentement les journaux pour Internet et les annonceurs délaisseront lentement la presse écrite pour Internet, ce qui provoquera une crise pour la presse écrite, une crise très grave. Moi, je suis très inquiet pour l'avenir des journaux parce que les journaux, ça reste, à cause de l'importance des salles de rédaction, du nombre de journalistes à l'emploi des journaux et du fait que la majorité des autres médias sont à la remorque des journaux, c'est-à-dire puisent leur information dans les journaux. Pour moi, la presse écrite, ça reste, à cause de ces salles de rédaction imposantes, le média le plus important. Je ne sais pas si tu es d'accord, mais allez-y, mon ami.
Thank you. I'm glad, Florian, you quoted that opening line from the Kent Commission report, because in fact, I mean, this is something that we have to, we can't say that often enough, because in fact, freedom of the press and more broadly, freedom of expression, not only in Canada, but in democratic countries worldwide, really does operate at different levels, depending on whether one actually has the means of communication in their hands or not. And a few years ago, I published with some colleagues a book that we called Media Divides, which was a kind of a democratic audit of the state of communications in Canada, in which we argued that freedom of expression in Canada is a two-tiered freedom, because everyone has the formal right to freedom of expression, but it's exercised so differentially depending on where one is in society. And for a report like the Kent Commission, a Royal Commission report to underscore this fact is really quite impressive. And there was another report from a slightly earlier period which did not focus on journalism per se, but on communications more broadly. It was actually focused on telecommunication at the time. And they called for a right to communicate, or more broadly speaking, a set of communication rights. So it's interesting that there have been no shortage of interesting proposals coming from public bodies, high-level public bodies, as well as grassroots organizations, non-governmental associations, and different areas of civil society, and, of course, from journalists and journalist associations themselves. And I think if we look back as a way of informing the debate on where we're headed, the problems facing journalism in Canada and Quebec have not really changed in the past century. They basically come down to a question of the relationship between commerce and public service. I mean, we can't get away from this reality. The efforts to use public policy that Florian mentions, and here I would certainly include the report that he co-authored with Jerry Kaplan in 1986 on broadcasting policy. They all have in common that they situate journalism and media more broadly as something that should be looked at outside, or at best alongside, the sphere of commerce and business, although they recognize the place of private commercial enterprise in the media. But media essentially have a public role to play, and this can best be guaranteed by a concerted public policy approach and a mix of independent public institutions like the CBC and the National Film Board, an independent regulatory authority which has a mandate by law to operate under broad policy guidelines, and we have such an authority in Canada, the CRTC, and public support through funding as well as structural regulation of a range of media institutions, including independent, not for-profit, non-commercial, community-based media. And if you go through the policy documents and the policy proposals, you'll find that all of these are mentioned there, and yet our governments never follow through on that. So our history is littered with excellent proposals and a remarkable lack of political will to carry them through. And this has got to change, or we're going to face a serious environmental crisis in the media. I think we're already in the phase of global warming with respect to mainstream media, but let's see where we can go.
On prend beaucoup de temps. Alors, je pense personnellement que la crise que craint Marc, nous la vivons, cette crise-là. Il y a une perte de crédibilité des grands médias, en particulier auprès des jeunes générations qui ne croient plus beaucoup à d'une part à cause de la concentration, puis à cause des liens qu'ils voient entre, ce qui n'est pas toujours le cas d'ailleurs, bien au contraire, entre les journalistes et les directions de médias, mais de toute façon, la perte de crédibilité chez les jeunes générations est là. Il y a aussi la question que pose ce colloque, maintenant que tout le monde peut devenir journaliste ou peut être faire son propre journalisme avec le journalisme dit citoyen, est-ce qu'on a, il y a un livre publié en France il y a quelques mois qui pose la question, c'est le titre du livre, « A-t-on encore besoin des journalistes ?» Alors, personnellement, je pense qu'on a encore besoin des journalistes dans la mer d'informations qui nous inonde. Hein, l'idée de « information overload », c'est vrai, on la vit tous les jours. Je pense qu'on a encore besoin de quelqu'un pour hiérarchiser un peu tout ça. Mais encore une fois, je répète, je pense que la crise, elle est à nos portes. Et je lisais récemment le compte-rendu d'un livre qui vient d'être publié en Grande-Bretagne où il y a, comme en Australie, il y a des enquêtes sur la déontologie, l'éthique des médias. Et il y a un des auteurs d'un livre collectif qui dit « À quoi bon s'interroger sur l'éthique des médias si bientôt il n'y a plus de médias ?» Je pense qu'il faut se poser des questions de cette nature-là. Et moi, je m'inquiète surtout sur les salles de rédaction où la synergie entre journalistes est importante, où la culture journalistique, la culture du service public dont Marc a parlé se transmet. Et je crains que dans l'avenir, on n'ait plus les ressources financières pour financer ces grandes salles de rédaction. Il faut quand même espérer que d'une autre manière, un journalisme de service public remplace celui-là si jamais on le perd. Mais on verra bien, encore une fois, je l'ai dit au départ, moi, je n'ai pas de réponse. J'essaie du mieux possible de ne pas être trop fumiste. Alors, Marc, c'est toi qui auras le dernier mot.
Well, I'm actually upbeat about the future of journalism, which I think has much more to promise than the future of many of the mainstream media institutions that we've been talking about and given the problems that they face. The reason I say that is that people want news and information, and they will find ways to make it, and they will find it when it's out there and available. And I'm encouraged by the presence and the rise of a new generation of young journalists. I'm confident that new forms of journalistic expression will continue to emerge. The internet is a new technological frontier. And I think the focus for both citizens and journalists needs to be on keeping the internet open and accessible as a space for public discourse. There will be good and bad information on the internet, just like there were and are good and bad newspapers, magazines, radio, and television. But if the platform remains open and accessible, the rest will fall into place. And in order to be sure that happens, we need to remain vigilant. Now, in the London Guardian this week, there's a seven-part series called Battle for the Internet, in which a whole range, I don't know if you had a chance to look at that, it's really worth a look, a range of gurus, shall we say, including the founder of Google, Sergey Brin, scholar Jonathan Zittrain, and the creator of the World Wide Web, Sir Tim Berners-Lee, all warned that these principles by which the Internet has evolved are under threat by a combination of governments interested in controlling citizens' communication, the entertainment industry's use of patents, copyright, and IP protection in its attempts to crack down on piracy, and the rise of internet silos, walled gardens, and appliances rather than applications under the proprietary control of huge corporate empires like Apple, Facebook, and Google itself. I think that's the kind of thing that we need to be concerned about and thinking of ways to address in this conference and elsewhere. Thank you.
Merci beaucoup à tous les deux d'avoir lancé la discussion. Wow, I don't know if we're going to be able to take on Google at the end of this conference. That may be a bit more ambitious even than we had planned. Mais c'est sûr que cet échange, je trouve, introduit ou assure une transition intéressante vers la table ronde que nous allons entendre à l'instant. Qui porte en fait, qui sera composé d'anciens journalistes professionnels et qui vont nous parler, je suppose, de leur action, en fait, de leur intervention, justement pour réfléchir, pour penser à des façons, si on veut, de réinventer ou de soutenir le journaliste de l'avenir. So our next panel is going to address actually this question of what we are going to do or what we are doing for journalism in the future. And I'm just going to introduce our host, Mike Finnerty, who's the host of CBC Montreal's Daybreak on Radio 1, formerly multimedia news editor for The Guardian and editor of daytime programs at BBC World Service. So over to you, Mike.
Good evening. Bonsoir, tout le monde. Fascinating discussion and refreshing to hear things go back and forth. In French and English, it's like the supper table. I would like to welcome all here, and I'd like to introduce you to our panel tonight. We're going to have some brief introductory remarks, but then we're really going to hopefully let her rip, and by the end of the evening, we'll open the floor up to you, and we'll hope that you're taking notes, things that come to mind, things that you'd like to address to the panel. You're very welcome to do that toward the end of the discussion. As a means of introduction and kind of setting the table, I prepared a couple of headlines, well, 11 headlines from the news, and just things that I've picked out over the past couple of months, maybe even back as far as a year ago. Number one, Quebec students strike. 2 months and counting, minister won't back down until the one student group accepts to condemn the violence and vandalism that's taken place. Red Square has become must-have spring accessory. Kony 2012 video on Ugandan Lord's Resistance Army exceeds 100 million views around the world. CBC Radio-Canada cuts $195 million from its budget access dispatches on CBC Radio. The finance minister's budget announces a requirement for Canadian charities to provide more information on political advocacy and their foreign sources of funding. Occupy encampments spring up on Wall Street outside St. Paul's Cathedral in Montreal, Toronto, and around the Western world. Rupert Murdoch's News Corp pays out millions in wake of phone hacking scandal. James Murdoch resigns from a series of boards, including Sky News. Regimes fall across the Middle East, but where the Arab Spring will lead remains uncertain. In a modern-day Jerry Maguire moment, Kai Nagata quits CTV News and publishes a manifesto on the poverty of Canadian television journalism. Former Radio-Canada journalist Dominique Payette publishes a report recommending Quebec journalists become registered professionals. Canadian author and activist Judy Rebick publishes Occupy This, arguing the Occupy movement is the rising up of a generation. And former CBC News boss Tony Berman becomes Al Jazeera's managing director for the English service, which now reaches more than 220 million viewers globally, and gets patted on the back by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton for reporting, quote, real news. So welcome to your panel, if I can have them come up. Judy Rebick, writer and broadcaster, founding publisher of Rabble.ca, and former CBC News World host. She's currently media panel on Q Radio, and her book, latest book is Occupy This. Dominique Payette, former Radio-Canada journalist, now teaches at Laval, and recently authored a report on the future of journalism for the government of Quebec. Kai Nagata, there he is, former CBC and CTV reporter, touched off the debate on the plurality of broadcast journalism in Canada with a blog post, sort of that Jerry Maguire moment I talked about. He's now writer-in-residence at the TIE. And Tony Berman, who is Velma Roger Chair in News, Media, and Technology at Ryerson University, formerly Managing Director at Al Jazeera English and CBC. Welcome to you all. I'm going to ask you if you could, before we get to the back and forth, to speak. I hope you'll aim more toward the 5 minutes, 5 to 10 minutes maximum. And if I could ask you, by the time you're finished speaking, to address where you think we are now in terms of Canadian journalism and our democracy. We really want to anchor this discussion in the now, and it's been excellent to hear the two of you set the table of how we got to where we are. But I'll begin in reverse alphabetical order, and Judy Rebick, if you'd kick it off.
I was hoping I wouldn't be first. Today's the 11th anniversary of Rabble.ca. That's another headline. not reported in the mainstream, but a really fairly miraculous fact. Where are we now? The best way I can say this is that I started teaching a graduate course on media democracy in 2002 at Ryerson. And at the time, we'd study the usual texts, Noam Chomsky, et cetera, et cetera. And I'd always make the distinction and say, well, the Canadian media is different than the American media. We have to make a distinction, primarily because of the CBC. But, it's not as right-wing, it's not as controlled, it's not as narrow in its view. And as the years went on, I had to change that. I had to change the course. It actually happened before my eyes that the media, and it was a conscious intervention. We heard the name Conrad Black earlier, and it was a conscious intervention by the National Post in part. And in another part, it was the entire hegemonization of neoliberalism and neoliberalism thought in 5 minutes. We can't get into that. So that's one thing that's happened, that there has been an incredible narrowing of media opinion. There has been an incredible decline, in my view, of quality in the media, and that includes on the CBC, not so much Radio-Canada, but on the English CBC, especially television. And there has been an increasing cynicism about the media, I think well placed. On the other hand, there has been the rise of an alternative media, which we've always had, as Mark pointed out. There's always been an alternative media, but as someone who's always worked in more or less an alternative media, it's possible to reach more people now, way more people, because of the media. I call social media is like a megaphone for alternative media. And if you look at Occupy, for example, Occupy was able to actually bypass the mainstream media in the United States. We're not at that point in Canada. By combining the alternative media like The Nation, Mother Jones, which I hadn't heard from since the 70s, all of a sudden became quite prominent, and other media, Democracy Now!, with social media, live streaming, YouTube videos, et cetera, so that they were able to reach millions of people directly with information from Occupy. bypassing and countering the mainstream media. We're not at that stage yet in Canada, but I think we're moving in that direction. So I think we're in a very sorry state of media, I would say. I'm on Q, on the media panel on Q Radio, so I debate the media every other week, sort of. And it's sad. I would say it's very sad. I think the media has become highly elitist. And the last thing I want to say is I'm wearing my red square. Of course, if I was still a TV host on CBC, I couldn't wear my red square. But they would ask me to wear a poppy on November 11th. And I would have to rebel not to wear a poppy on November 11th. And I think there tells you something right there about where the media is at and what the media represents. And that's nothing new. And I said to Kai, and I'll end on this, even though I'm not supposed to talk about the past, that 1967, I quit being a journalist for many of the same reasons he quit being a journalist last year. So even though there's been a deterioration in the media, it's always represented the interests of the status quo. Most of the mainstream media, as Mark has pointed out, that hasn't changed. It's just the status quo has moved considerably to the right and considerably less democratic than it was 20, 30 years ago.
So the present for journalism, sad, according to Judy Revick. And Dominique Payette, if you could take it on from there.
This presentation will be in French. Il y a de la traduction simultanée. Lorsque le rapport est sorti l'année dernière, il a été reçu d'une manière assez brutale par la communauté anglophone du Québec. Alors je vous invite à m'écouter en français cette fois pour être sûr qu'on va bien se comprendre. Je trouve extraordinaire ce qui se produit, cette espèce de démocratie directe à travers les médias. Alors je voudrais qu'on me comprenne bien, encore une fois, si je pense qu'il s'agit d'un événement exceptionnel dans l'histoire de l'humanité, que le plus grand nombre de personnes possibles puissent émettre leur opinion, puissent prendre des photos d'un accident qui se produit au coin de la rue, etc. Je trouve ça extraordinaire, mais ça n'est pas du journalisme. Le journalisme, ça n'est pas que ça. Et tout à l'heure, mon éminent collègue Florian parlait de cette époque où les journalistes étaient des pontifs. Je le trouve un peu dur, parce que pour moi, le journalisme, ça n'est pas pontifier, c'est appliquer une méthode. Et ce qui m'inquiète actuellement, c'est la disparition, non pas des journalistes, encore qu'il y en a quelques-uns que je trouve sympathiques, mais c'est la disparition de la méthode journalistique. Et je pense que comme société, c'est là que nous sommes en danger. Essayez de noter dans les jours qui viennent à combien d'occasions vous allez entendre des journalistes parler au conditionnel. Ce qui en français signifie qu'ils ne sont pas sûrs de ce qu'ils avancent. Il y a 15 ans, si j'avais utilisé le conditionnel, je pense que j'aurais été congédiée. Alors, il s'est produit quelque chose de très important au cours de ces 15 dernières années, non seulement les pressions qui viennent de produire de plus rapidement, mais il s'est produit aussi une rupture du contrat social que nous avons comme société au Québec avec des entreprises privées que nous avons chargées de nous informer tout en leur permettant de s'enrichir, et de s'enrichir énormément. On pense beaucoup à la presse écrite quand on pense à la concentration, mais essayez d'imaginer, je pense qu'il y a beaucoup d'anglophones dans la salle qui ne savent peut-être pas ça, mais il y a plein de stations de radio à travers le Québec qui n'ont plus aucune salle de nouvelles. Et contrairement à mon ami Florian, je crois que la presse écrite est très importante, mais il y a un tiers de la population du Québec qui a du mal à lire. Donc, pour cette partie de la population, la radio est le média privilégié pour s'informer. Et ces radios-là ont complètement abandonné, malgré le CRTC et malgré tous les contrôles qui sont supposés exister, ont complètement renoncé à remplir leur contrat social avec nous. Pourquoi ? Parce qu'elles ont besoin d'un rendement de 21% à l'investissement. Et on a laissé faire, on a laissé aller, on a laissé disparaître, au fond, cette partie-là de leur contrat social. C'est vrai aussi des entreprises de presse écrites qui ont de plus... Vous voyez, je parle de moins en moins des médias, parce que je ne veux plus parler des médias, parce que les médias, c'est n'importe quoi. Mais le journalisme à l'intérieur des médias, c'est quelque chose de fondamental. Mais on est en train de perdre le journalisme qui a été le raison d'être dans ce contrat social au profit de tout ce qui est sweet stories et autres petites histoires et anecdotes qui sont très légères et qui font mieux vendre le journal. Donc l'information d'intérêt public, c'est celle qui coûte le plus cher à produire, c'est celle qui demande des reporters sur le terrain, c'est celle qui demande de prendre du temps, et celle-là, les entreprises de presse veulent de moins en moins en faire, parce que la publicité est de moins en moins intéressée, et parce que s'ils n'ont pas le rendement nécessaire pour satisfaire leurs actionnaires, ils sont dans la chenoute. Je ne sais pas comment on traduit chenoute. Alors, on peut aussi regarder les choses aller comme ça. Puis là, je vous parle encore de Montréal et de Québec, je vous parle des grandes villes. Quand on a fait l'étude pour le gouvernement du Québec, on s'est promené à travers le Québec, il y a des endroits désertiques. Le Témiscouata, je ne sais pas si ça vous dit quelque chose. Le Témiscouata, c'est un immense territoire qui est habité par environ 20 000 personnes. 20 000 personnes au Québec, dans le marché de l'information aujourd'hui, ça n'intéresse plus qui que ce soit. Même pas le communautaire, c'est vous dire. Alors, qu'est-ce qu'on fait par rapport à cette situation où le contrat social n'est plus respecté par une des deux parties? On a choisi, dans le rapport que j'ai fait, d'être extrêmement pragmatique, parce qu'on a constaté, comme mon ami Florian, que ça fait 40 ans qu'on dit au gouvernement fédéral et provincial que le problème, c'est la concentration. Et ça fait 40 ans que ni l'un ni l'autre ne fait rien. Alors, on s'est dit, qu'est-ce qu'on peut faire? Parce qu'il fallait se mettre sur le mode solution, parce que je ne trouve extrêmement patient et passif par rapport à cette information qui est de moins en moins destinée à des citoyens et de moins en moins destinée à en former des nouveaux. Alors, on s'est dit qu'on ne pourra pas s'attaquer aux empires. Pourquoi? Parce qu'il n'y a jamais personne qui l'a fait, puis il n'y a pas un gouvernement, ni à Québec, ni à Ottawa, qui n'aura jamais le courage de remettre le dentifrice dans le tube. Donc, ils ne défront pas, ils ne démantèleront pas les empires, inutile d'y penser. Mais qu'est-ce qu'on peut faire? On peut construire, là je suis dans un milieu anglophone, je vais voir si ça marche, on peut construire des villages gaulois. OK? On peut faire des astérix. On peut résister à l'invasion. On a un réseau, par exemple, de médias communautaires au Québec qui est exceptionnel. Il y a des endroits où ils ont vraiment pris la place du privé qui ne faisait plus assez d'argent. Alors, il faut soutenir ça. Il faut que l'État, c'est-à-dire nous tous, nous décidions de soutenir le journalisme partout où il s'exerce, par exemple, dans le communautaire. Mais aussi, vous savez que dans les hebdos, en ce moment, il y a une guerre épouvantable dont la principale victime est la qualité de l'information. Il y a une guerre commerciale entre Transcontinental et Québécois qui fait que dans les hebdos en ce moment, le prix des publicités a tellement baissé, ça ne sert plus à rien même, ça ne finance plus rien. Dans les hebdos au Québec en ce moment, il y a un journaliste et demi par hebdo en moyenne. Au moment où tous ces hebdos essaient de faire le virage sur Internet avec du updating quotidien. Donc, il est impossible que la qualité de l'information ne soit pas la première victime de ce qui se passe en ce moment dans les hebdos. Alors, pour revenir à mes villages gaulois, ce que je souhaitais faire, c'est que l'État intervienne directement pour subventionner à hauteur de 38% l'embauche de journalistes. Vous savez, le Québec l'a fait dans le jeu vidéo, c'est ce qui fait que le Québec se classe parmi les premiers au monde dans le jeu vidéo. Alors, on aurait fait quoi? On aurait financé à hauteur de 38% l'embauche de nouveaux journalistes dans les hebdos, privés, pas privés, communautaires, indépendants, pour soutenir tout ce qui est information locale et régionale, qui est en train de disparaître dans certaines régions complètement. Et parallèlement à ça, les entreprises de presse qui bénéficient de ces subventions sont des entreprises de presse qui sont membres du Conseil de presse du Québec. Pourquoi? Parce qu'on peut très difficilement obliger Québécois à revenir au Conseil de presse. On peut difficilement passer une loi d'auto-réglementation. On ne peut pas obliger quelqu'un à s'auto-réglementer. Mais ce qu'on peut faire, c'est les inciter tellement sur le plan financier qu'on change complètement. On inverse le paradigme. Au lieu de profiter de l'exclusion pour faire ce qu'ils veulent sur le plan de la déontologie, on les incite à en faire partie pour bénéficier des avantages financiers. Autrement dit, on parle la même langue. C'est-à-dire le fric. Et dans le marché de concurrence, ça veut dire qu'on sort la déontologie de la concurrence. Ça veut dire que tout le monde doit appliquer la même déontologie, même ceux qui ne veulent pas. Ça veut dire que les pratiques professionnelles seraient régies de la même manière, ils seraient exclus de la concurrence, alors qu'elles le sont en ce moment. En ce moment, il y a des raccourcis incroyables qui sont pris par des jeunes journalistes. Je dis des jeunes parce que c'est principalement des jeunes qui sont en région en ce moment, soumis à des pressions commerciales épouvantables, et qui, dans certains cas, je reçois des téléphones à l'université de gens qui me disent « Voyons, Madame Payette, est-ce que je suis obligée de faire ça ?» Mais qu'est-ce que vous voulez que je leur dise si c'est leur job qui est en jeu? Alors, ce qu'il faut, c'est trouver une façon de redonner de l'autonomie aux journalistes, parce que c'est seulement eux qui vont nous garantir le journalisme que nous souhaitons. Et c'était donc l'essentiel du projet que j'avais soumis au gouvernement du Québec, qui a reçu, ce rapport a reçu un accueil bien au-delà de mes attentes, non seulement des journalistes eux-mêmes, mais aussi de l'Association des jeunes libéraux, du Parti québécois, etc. Donc, vraiment un rapport qui a suscité au moment où on l'a déposé beaucoup d'intérêt et qui doucement est en train de mourir de sa belle mort, notamment parce que les journalistes ne s'entendent pas entre eux sur qui va gérer ce statut de journaliste. Alors, il y en a qui voudraient en ce moment que ce soit l'État lui-même qui décrète un code de déontologie, ce avec quoi je suis entièrement en désaccord. Donc, il y a des tentatives pour essayer de rescaper certains éléments là-dedans. Mais, si vous voulez, on en reparlera tout à l'heure, parce que non seulement ça permet une intervention financière de l'État, ça permet de ramener aussi une discussion entre des journalistes non syndiqués et leur employeur, parce que s'ils sont obligés d'aller contre leur code de déontologie, ça veut dire que l'entreprise ne sera plus financée, peut-être, et qu'à ce moment-là, on fait reposer la responsabilité à la fois sur l'entreprise et sur le journaliste de respecter ce code de déontologie. Je vais terminer peut-être juste rapidement. C'est un an de travail, vous me permettez quand même de le résumer. Oui, alors, non, je reviendrai tout à l'heure si vous avez des questions. Bon, ça va être préférable.
Merci beaucoup. Donc, une détérioration du journalisme dans le Québec moderne. Elle n'a pas employé le mot « triste », mais on l'a bien sous-entendu, je pense. Ensuite, Kai Nagata, if you could take on the topic of the day.
Okay, full disclosure, I actually worked briefly on Mike's show at the CBC, so if he goes easy on me, you can give him hell. I also just barely missed Tony Berman's tenure. Which, depending on who you ask, is either a good thing or a very, very sad thing. But I was working in the Maison Radio Canada here in Montreal in fall 2008 when Western capitalism faltered. I'm just curious who here, by a show of hands, was working in a newsroom at the time? A pretty healthy proportion. I wonder if you remember the anxiety of covering this kind of borderless meltdown, and wondering whether it was going to affect our own jobs. And indeed, it did, because next March I watched Richard Sturzberg pop up on the teleconferencing screen and cut 800 jobs at the CBC, and because these things tend to happen in clusters, if you recall, Sun Media cut, I think, 600, Post Media cut 560, and of course it was way, way worse in the States, and it's still bad there, and now it's bad again at the CBC, thanks to the sort of continuing effects of that same recession. So I don't think it's radical to suggest that there's a correlation between your job security as a journalist and the health of the overall economy. But what I'm saying is that it influences editorial. As Dr. Raboy pointed out in the opening panel, and Dr. Payette points to as well, public interest journalism and, you know, free market economics are strange dance partners. Doesn't mean they can't make it work, but they need a fair amount of leeway. And as those profit margins shrink, and as smaller players are squeezed out, you know, we're only, I don't know, three mergers away from a broadcasting monopoly, that tension becomes a little harder to ignore. So I think it's most obvious the more expensive your production costs are relative to your audience, and my views on television are a matter of public record, but obviously newspapers have had trouble too. And one thing that Dr. Payette's report points to, in my interpretation, is this lack of consensus in evaluating or even defining journalism, because we might think internally that we have clear policies or that we have
a strong internal news sense or news culture, but I think that to the general public, our editorial decisions can seem pretty arbitrary. And that might have something to do with the fact that journalism is only quasi-scientific, and we probably like it that way. And in that, I think it resembles the discipline of economics. So here's the crux of the problem, right? Public or private, these journalistic operations are dependent on the same economic model that they report on in the course of their duties. And in any other context, we would call that a conflict of interest. And I can point to some smaller examples within newsrooms of people that probably should have excused themselves from coverage of particular stories due to personal interests, but I'm talking about a much broader pattern. It's not a partisan bias. It's not a big conspiracy. I'm not talking about corporate kleptocrats getting together in weird hoods and whipping each other with juniper bushes and planning the overthrow of the world. I think it's just the water, right? And we're the fish that swim in it. And we, to some degree, have to uphold and sustain this model because that's what keeps us employed. But if you perform the exercise that Mike did at the very beginning, you lay out those front pages, those headlines, and you kind of blur your eyes like you're looking at a magic eye painting, you might get the sense that the model itself is in a fair amount of trouble. And I'm talking about this notion of perpetual growth. I don't know who kept fish as a kid, but if you put too many fish in an aquarium, it's messy. There's this idea that within a closed system that we can continue to grow our economy forever with finite resources. And that goes along with our network profits, right? Our ratings, our viewership, our subscriptions, our retirement savings. And this ideology, let's call it what it is integral not just to our industry as journalists, but to many aspects of our everyday lives. The problem is that, unfortunately, the math doesn't work. You talk to a physicist about the laws of thermodynamics, or, hell, talk to any scientist that you're still allowed to interview, and they will tell you something similar. What we see around us are symptoms of this gradual breakdown of that growth model, and we report on these symptoms every day. Expanding inequality, endless debt, the erosion of public services. Those tuition protests outside are a reflection of a larger experience being undergone by young people in Spain and in Greece and in Chile and in California and so on. I think many of our headlines reflect tentacles of the same big story, except, of course, when they don't. Maybe you remember back so long ago when celebrities would show up to the Academy Awards in Priuses and these hybrid cars. The Toronto Star did this study, or they reported actually on a study by Dr. Andrew Weaver, of the incidence of mentions, I guess, the rate at which we talk about climate change and global warming, I think were the two search terms. And it's a pretty simple study. He looked at five newspapers across Canada, five major urban dailies. And since that Al Gore peak in 2007, every single year since then, these words have diminished and disappeared from our pages, which is funny, not ha-ha funny, but the planet clearly continues to get warmer. So it is a strange kind of inverse correlation. And that is, I think, one of the most dangerous pieces of the sort of hard scientific evidence that I'm talking about, that this economic model is not sustainable. But, of course, that's inconvenient, as Al Gore put it, so it's not surprising to me that we edit it out of our coverage. So you'll notice I'm not wearing a sandwich board or a loincloth tonight. I shaved the beard. It was getting a little bit itchy, and I'm not here to quote from the book of Revelations, but there is a part of the Bible that talks about not building your house on sand, and I think in scientific, secular terms, if you build your house or you premise a system on faulty theory, you're in for disappointment. So as long as our institutions are married to this perpetual growth model, I think they're going to be increasingly dysfunctional. And that includes democracy, and that includes journalism. So as things gradually break down, I mean, this could be a process of decades or centuries, as these natural systems and political systems break down, the cool thing is the stories are just going to get better and better, right? Austerity riots, revolution, corruption, resource wars, Turcotte Interchange. I think these are the stories that cry out to be covered, and someone needs to be there to connect the dots, whether it's somebody with their cell phone who's blogging, or somebody who's got years of experience and training. Somebody needs to be there connecting these seemingly disparate events. And so I think that journalism is going to become more important, not less. But if our information gathering capacity is crippled every time the economy takes a downturn, or every time the deficit needs to be macheted away by the finance minister, then how can we do our jobs? How can we speak truth to power, comfort the afflicted, afflict the comfortable? It's a difficult question. And the short answer, I think, is that we need to make ourselves less vulnerable. Our careers, our newsrooms, production budgets, our organizations need to move toward this big idea of sustainability. And this is clearly an all-encompassing challenge, and nobody yet has figured out exactly what that's going to look like. But in this pursuit of sustainability, I think that as journalists, we will make ourselves, first of all, more independent, and second of all, far more relevant. We have an opportunity to serve this hugely important role in the overall transition if we can stop clinging to these old models and start looking at inspiration from outside the silo of our industry. So the long answer, I hope, is something we can explore over this weekend. We need to think about making journalism as a practice resilient enough to weather a complete economic rethink, because it's already happening, and we need to be out there covering it. Thank you.
Well, we're moving from sadness to desperation as we move down the table. And Tony Berman, if you could pick it up from there.
No, I know. I think I'm recommending collective suicide. The first wave is at 9:30, and we'll do it in half-hour intervals. The sun is shining in my little part of the universe, and I'll get to it. So that's right.
It's a halogen lamp.
Either that, or let's start drinking heavily here. No, I think one's answer, one's kind of approach, obviously, to these issues depends on your starting point, and my starting point is pretty obvious through my career. I've been involved most of my life, virtually all of my working life, in public broadcasting at the CBC, mainly also, and I do view Al Jazeera as a public broadcaster for almost 4 years at Al Jazeera. But I also, if I can say this with Mark Raboy being here, I mean, I too, kind of my sense of journalism and the public role of journalism and how journalism should be an agent of social change also came from the 60s in here in Quebec, university journalism, and I too, like Mark, began my professional career in the incredible newsroom of the Montreal Star in the late 60s and early 70s, where Evelyn Dumont was seated in front of me, Jean-Vé Dufresne was to my right, and for a young journalist trying to figure out why do we go to all this effort to do what we're doing, they were incredible role models. But let me fast forward to May of 2007. That's when I began as the managing director of Al Jazeera English, based in Qatar, in that little country, incredibly wealthy but incredibly small, that was the host of this amazing network called Al Jazeera. And part of my mandate, and I was managing director of the English channel, which was had a staff of 1,200 people, 50 nationalities. It was a incredible experience from that point of view, and again, over the 3 years I was with them, we were able to build and build and build our kind of audience research, but our audience reach and worldwide. But what I found kind of surprising in May of 2007 when I arrived was that what the dominant part of Al Jazeera were two television channels, the Arabic channel, of which we are so familiar, and the English channel, which at that point had been on the air for a year, that their actual online service was somewhat of a secondary concern for that organization. Social media was not a term that was talked about in the Arab world, and dare I say, in the media world that existed there. And I found that somewhat surprising in the sense that it reminded me, if you're going to create a kind of a new, I'm thinking of Al Jazeera English, a new channel and a new kind of enterprise in 2006, 2007, one would think that you would actually put the whole kind of multi-platform idea in the middle of, at the beginning of your gaze, but that wasn't the case. And part of my mandate was to help with others to change that around, because what I did when I got there, since I walked into this organization where I knew zero people, and I talked to a lot of people, and the striking thing of the Al Jazeera staff is they're about 5 or 6 years, almost on average, younger than the CBC or Al-Azhar Canada or the BBC. It's because it's a startup, it's a very young staff, and in that sense, incredibly kind of open to change. And the overwhelming message to me, not that I really needed to be sold on it, but it was incredibly reassuring, was that we in Al Jazeera, both Arabic and English, have got to kind of get with the program and really get into multi-platform use of social media, interacting with our audience, etc., etc. And that developed. That developed in 2007. It developed in 2008. It surfaced very much in the awful Israeli Gaza conflict that occurred, where Jazeera, because Al Jazeera never left Gaza, was the only international news channel that was covering both sides of the issue, and a lot of it was being done. Streaming was being done on the web. Our audience in the U.S., where the TV channel was not nearly as accessible as it is now, the audience was overwhelmingly on the web. And so it really, we all kind of learned. And what we learned, what I learned, because when I was at the CBC, which was, I was editor-in-chief, head of News and Current Affairs from 2000 to 2007, and the challenge of the CBC, and I know at Radio Canada, and I know the Toronto Star, probably the Gazette, all of these organizations, we were trying to kind of get with the program. We were trying to kind of change ourselves from a one-platform organization to a multi-platform organization, and there was a lot of resistance among staff. You know, are we going to weave in all of this, these kind of untrained journalists, these viewers, readers who aren't credible, et cetera, et cetera. So there's in so-called legacy institutions that have, you know, proud histories, I think there's always been a kind of resistance. So that was kind of the environment that I left at the CBC, and then here I come to Doha, to Qatar, where there is an incredible need to turn this ship around, but there's also an incredible enthusiasm and energy to do that. And that was done. We did it kind of gradually. And this was well before we knew that the Arab Spring would occur. And then December, I always lose track of my years, was it 2000 and would have been 2010, I think, December. And then the first incidents occurred, the first protests occurred in Tunisia. And Al Jazeera, the unknown story of Al Jazeera is that it may have had a kind of tensions with the U.S. government, but it's had years and years of tensions with the Arab dictatorships. It's been thrown out of every Arab country that one could imagine. And the tyrants in Tunisia, in Egypt, obviously in Syria, were really out to target Al Jazeera. So Jazeera's journalists were, throughout the so-called Arab Spring, were able to only to cover the stories kind of undercover without giving names, more or less in secret. And the great breakthrough was that we the Al Jazeera in Doha, just got inundated with people who were able to cover the story through their little mobiles, their cell phones. And it was an amazing an amazing quantity each day, and that so here you had a news organization that probably 6 months prior to the beginning of the Arab Spring was as skeptical and indifferent to this kind of social media role in the telling of our modern story, and it totally turned around. Part of it was practical, that the only way that Al Jazeera could get access to many of these stories in Tunisia, in Syria, in Egypt, obviously, in Libya, was through the input and output of just ordinary people who had inundated Doha. But what it did, what it created in Qatar, it forced Jazeera to create various desks to verify and to double check, and it really became a very sophisticated and a very kind of well-run process whereby, rather than kind of looking at so-called user-generated content as a hindrance, Jazeera decided to really kind of to capture it and to use it and to do it in ways that is a pattern and is a part of its channel, both Arabic and English, to this day. And it's now has channels in Turkish and channels in about three or four other languages. And I think what one finds, and it's remarkable how far this organization has come since May of 2007, that the whole idea that this new technology that is now available to everyone, the accessibility of news organizations, in this case Jazeera, to actually access, to get their hands on this kind of material. But as long as you can kind of create a way to ensure that this flood is organized, is managed, is verified, is double-checked, there are countless examples of where things were stopped, where things were put on the air for a matter of seconds, and then somebody recognized that it was a... So there's... I won't get into those examples, but I mean, I think the two lessons for me, and I'll kind of cut it off here, because I know there's a lot that we can discuss. The two lessons for me, to get back to university journalism in the 60s and, dare I say, news organizations like the Montreal Star at that period, that journalism really can be still, in spite of all of these incredible problems that confront us, can be a tool for positive social change. And I think that's something that those of us who are privileged to work in the area of journalism, I think, can never forget, in spite of the incredible black clouds that increasingly distract us. The second thing, which I don't think is restricted to the developing world and is, I understand, a particular kind of concern of Dominique that she's made in the past, which is the media... The vibrancy of a political environment has a lot to do with a public's ability to use the media for its own interests. In other words, I think what happened throughout the Arab world is they realized that the media really is a way out of their bind. You know, and I think fortunately there were many news organizations, not only Jazeera, but many news organizations that learned the same, that they too kind of in partnership with. And I don't think that's something that's unique to the developing world. I think that's something that we should. I mean, we look, and as somebody, I feel sometimes I'm Rip Van Winkle. I've been in the Middle East for more than 3 years, and then I come back to Washington for a year. And I'm kind of trying to kind of cope with all of the, you know, the media, particularly in the U.S., is just going deeply, deeply into the sewer on so many levels. And I my fear, and this is contrary to my keep this a sunny disposition here, so this will be a quick thing, you know, and I fear also that we in Canada have a tendency sometimes to import the worst qualities of the U.S. media. So I think it's something we should be concerned about. But I really do think that if you look at the political, as somebody who's kind of landed back in civilization here, to look at a political culture that is broken, a political system, in my view, without sounding partisan, that is broken, that I think that we can learn from the Tunisians, the Libyans, the Egyptians, and God bless them, the Syrians, you know, that politics can be a pathway to a better life, and the media, a kind of a really strong journalism culture, can be a really important tool to achieve that. I'll keep it there. But the sun is still shining in my part of the hall, I assure you.
I'm going to interject from my own perspective just for a minute before I throw it open to the forum. And I think, Dominique, it was you who said that you can't fight an empire. And if we're looking for signs of hope, I recall very clearly in 2009 when I started work at The Guardian in London. And certainly at that time, the Murdoch Empire News Corps was very much in the ascendancy. It was a time when I remember clearly James Murdoch was asked to give the son of Rupert Murdoch, the News Corps, of course, which joins Fox News, Times of London, Sunday Times, at the time the News of the World, the Sun, most of Sky News Television, now Wall Street Journal. I think that Wall Street Journal acquisition occurred during that time. I remember James Murdoch taking the keynote speech at one of the big media conferences in Britain and just eviscerating the BBC from start to finish. And it really did seem like things were just going to go that way and no other way. And then a journalist at The Guardian by the name of Nick Davis began to break stories about how Murdoch reporters were hacking into cell phones of various people. At first, it didn't seem to create many waves. There was a, I cannot tell you how much of a sustained attack The Guardian came under as a result of those articles. Nick Davis testified before a parliamentary committee in Westminster about it. And we would, when we would go to media events and sit at The Guardian table, The Guardian would get hissed in the room for what Nick Davis was doing and what the paper was clearly doing by trying to uncover phone hacking. There was a body of opinion that felt very strongly that however you get a story by hook or by crook, good for you to get the story. The public didn't seem to care very much because most of the people who it emerged were being hacked tended to be celebrities. But in the end, it all fell to pieces on a day when it was revealed that one of the phones that was hacked was the mother of a girl who'd gone missing. And that girl, I believe her name was Millie Dowler, she had been murdered. And the mother had hope that she might be alive because she called the phone, her cell phone, to leave a message. And there was no room to leave a message, so that was a point where she thought she's not picking up her messages and she's clearly in distress. Well, then she would phone back, try to leave a message again, and suddenly she could leave a message, meaning that someone was clearing out her messages. Of course, the mother thought it was her. The mystery was never really cleared up until a few years later, and it turned out it was the News of the World that was hacking into those cellular phones. Nothing quite as far gone as what Stieg Larsson's characters do in The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, but things have gone very badly for the Murdoch empire since then, for News Corp since then, and they were, Dominique, you said you can't fight an empire, and Murdoch was on the verge of taking the controlling interest of Sky, which is a huge distribution network, something like, you know, Rogers or Bell. That got turned back. It is not happening any longer. I don't know, you know, how far this will go. Of course, the News of the World was shut down, and an inquiry has been set up in Britain called the Leveson Inquiry, which is looking root and branch at how the media and the press regulates itself. So there are, I think, hopeful signs that things can go too far, that it can be darkest before the dawn. But on that note, I'm going to move on, and I'm going to throw a couple of subjects out there for the panel. Now, in about 25 minutes, for those of you listening, you're very welcome to come up to one of the... Is there just one microphone? There's definitely one there. There might be another one there. But to give us about 25 minutes, can I start? I wanted to start global, but I think we should start very local. I mean, we're at Concordia University. I want to ask the panel about the student strike, or boycott, as the government calls it. Can a grassroots movement facing fairly implacable opposition with little support in the mainstream media or political culture carry the day? Judy Rebick.
Oh, of course. Absolutely. It's already happening. For one thing, I want to talk about journalism. Why is it the English media uses the word boycott? There's a history of student strikes in Quebec called strikes. The students call them strikes. Everybody calls them strikes. And yet the English media calls it boycott, which is the government word. And so, and this is supposed to be, how is this objective, right? It's just incredible to me. And the second thing I want to say is that
the government told us to use the word boycott.
Yeah, exactly. This is my point, right? It's not like it's the first time it's happened, right? There's a history going all the way back to the 70s of student strikes in Quebec. So I just want to point this out because of the thing about is journalism the problem? Journalism is the problem in the sense that how easily we cave, or no, I don't usually call myself a journalist anymore, you know, but how easily journalists cave to this kind of pressure. And it's often, now especially, about protests. So Tony's talking about the way in which Al Jazeera responded to the Arab Spring. But we see the opposite happening. And I don't think it's true so much in the Francophone media, at least not what I've read. I think the Francophone media, particularly what I read, I mean, I don't read the Journal de Montréal. I read, you know, Le Devoir, which has been amazing, La Presse, which hasn't been too bad. But Radio-Canada has been covering it very well. So for example, in Tout le monde en parle, which, you know, I come from English Canada, and I watched Tout le monde en parle when they were talking about the student strike, and they had Dominique, who's a famous filmmaker, I'm sorry, I don't know his last name.
Chopin.
Talk for like, I don't know, about, go after the minister of, one of the major ministers in the government about the student strike. It was incredible. You would never see that happen in English Canada these days. Never, ever, ever. Not because the ministers won't do it, and the media doesn't push it enough, right? But anyway, there is no coverage of the student strike in English Canada until there's violence. Zero. There has been zero coverage of the student strike. The biggest social movement that we've seen, not only in Quebec, but in Canada, in decades and decades, if not ever. And it's wonderful, this student strike. It's brilliantly led. It's, you know, I'm social movements is my expertise. I've never seen anything like this in Canada or Quebec. And yet there's no coverage of it. Absolutely no coverage until they smash up the minister's office. Then we have this very serious article in the Globe and Mail about how the strike's gone bad and blah, blah, blah.
Front page of the National Post this week, is this what Quebec students learn in school?
Right, right. Okay. My point exactly. So can the movement succeed? Yes. Why can the movement succeed? Because, I've been involved in social movements for a long time. I've never been involved in a social movement that had good media, ever, except for the pro-choice movement. Ever. Okay? Now maybe Tony wants to challenge me on that. I don't know. The media generally does not relate well to social movements, and yet we've managed to achieve a lot without good media coverage. And now we have our own tools that we didn't have. What I'd like to see is more journalists. I'm not so worried about professional journalism myself. I'd like to see more journalists take risks. That's what I'd like to see. And at the beginning of Occupy, we saw that. At the beginning of Occupy, particularly in the States, but also in Canada, you know, I would be getting calls from young journalists who were saying, I can't sell this story to my newsroom. Can you help me sell it? Right? I want to see more of that. I think we're going into a period where we're having a lot of social struggle. The reoccupations are going to happen in May. There's going to be big actions May Day. I'd like to see more coverage in the mainstream press, and I think for that to happen, some journalists, and particularly young journalists, are going to have to take some risks to cover it, and I'd like to see that.
Dominique, comment est-ce que le journalisme est en train de fonctionner en ce qui concerne la grève?
Je voudrais attirer votre attention sur quelque chose que Judy vient de dire que je trouve extrêmement grave. Elle a dit qu'elle ne lit pas le Journal de Montréal parce que ce qu'il y a dans le Journal de Montréal, c'est quelque chose de particulier. Et ce que je voudrais vous rappeler, les plus vieux d'entre vous, et dire aux plus jeunes, c'est qu'il n'y a pas de raison pour que les journalistes du Journal de Montréal ne fassent pas du bon journalisme, même s'ils s'adressent à une partie de la population qui est la partie la moins instruite, et justement parce que c'est la partie de la population la moins instruite. Alors, qu'est-ce qui s'est passé comme dérapage? Il s'est passé que les employeurs, les patrons de presse, ont un contrôle direct sur la salle de rédaction. C'est ça qui est nouveau. C'est ça qui n'existait pas. Il y avait, jusqu'à une dizaine d'années, une étanchéité très grande entre, un, la publicité et la salle de rédaction, et deux, entre les cadres supérieurs et les journalistes. Et il y a maintenant des demandes directes qui viennent des patrons de presse, à l'endroit de leurs journalistes. C'est vrai aussi sur la tribune parlementaire à Québec, où il y a eu des cas documentés d'intervention directe des propriétaires de presse. Donc avant, ça n'existait pas. Il n'y avait pas deux genres de déontologie journalistique, il n'y en avait qu'une seule. Ce qui permettait à un journaliste qui travaillait au Journal de Montréal d'écrire un article simple, mais correct, et qui n'était pas orienté comme son employeur voulait qu'il le soit. Et aujourd'hui, on a passé tout droit là-dessus. Autrement dit, je ne lis pas le Journal de Montréal parce que c'est devenu un journal de droite. Et ça n'est plus un journal de journalistes.
De Pierre Calpaledo.
Oui, et on se retrouve avec le même problème avec ces empires qui sont devenus beaucoup trop puissants. Alors, bon, je voulais d'abord utiliser ce petit exemple que Judy vient de me donner au passage pour faire un peu de kilométrage là-dessus.
Les étudiants.
Mais ça paraît beaucoup sur la grève des étudiants. Ça paraît beaucoup parce que, contrairement au mouvement étudiant des années 70 auquel moi j'ai participé, le mouvement est aujourd'hui très polarisé. À l'Université Laval, par exemple, les votes se prennent 49-51. Donc le mouvement est extrêmement divisé et il y a des jeunes très militants qui s'opposent au mouvement. Et ces jeunes-là, dans le fond, ils ont trouvé aussi où loger dans une presse qui est maintenant une presse aussi de droite. Donc on va trouver cette espèce de division à l'intérieur même des médias, ce qui, à mon avis, est extrêmement pernicieux. Parce que ça veut dire que vous n'aurez jamais une vision globale de la situation, mais vous allez avoir des journaux qui vont soutenir les étudiants qui sont opposés au mouvement parce qu'ils se sentent plus proches de ces étudiants-là. Alors, je ne peux pas faire un jugement ex cathedra sur tout ce qui s'est fait comme traitement, mais je pense que c'est très important de montrer ces éléments-là parce que c'est très dur pour la population d'avoir une vision critique de ce qu'elle lit. J'aime bien cette phrase qui dit qu'on ne sait pas ce qu'on ignore. C'est ce qui fait que le journal qu'on reçoit, à moins d'être un spécialiste des médias, c'est le journal qu'on aime, c'est le journal qu'on lit, c'est le journal avec lequel on est confortable. Mais le problème, c'est que tous ces journalistes-là n'exercent plus la même profession. Et c'est là où je pense que nous serons de plus en plus en danger.
Kai, the student strike in journalism, how do you think is it working?
Well, I think we see evidence in coverage. By the way, I live in BC, and apparently there's a strike in Quebec. I've had to, the day there were 200,000 people, how many kilometers of marchers was it? I had to go on, Facebook to find the photos, but...
Biggest demonstration since the Iraq War, we think.
I think it was bigger than the one in Iraq War.
Someone said Meech Lake or...
Meech Lake was never a dim.
I wasn't born. I think what we see is evidence of the polarization that Dominique Payette is referring to. And what we see is this erosion in the public discourse of the sort of middle ground, I guess, where you can actually have a discussion around policy options. Because the way that I've seen the debate framed in especially the Anglophone media is of a dualistic nature. It's framed as a generation war, and this is something that... we've seen a lot of evidence of, particularly in more conservative outlets, this idea that we have to think of the conflict in terms of a struggle between one generation and the other, or that it's a debate of right or left-wing ideology. And there are, in fact, I think, policy options in the middle there that answer the question of, if not this, then what? But we don't hear very much about that because we're so busy talking about vandals versus good students who want to go to class, or boomers versus Gen Y, or these radical lefties versus the state or the establishment. And I think that's a simplified view, but maybe that's what's easiest, I guess, on limited resources to come up with on deadlines. So. I'll just say that I think it's another example of the kind of deterioration of the public conversation.
Tony Berman.
Having just arrived in Montreal today, I'm not quite ready to provide a PhD thesis on this story. I mean, I tend to kind of agree, I think, with the direction of our three panelists, but just for the purposes of time, I don't think I have anything original to add to it.
I'm going to go from the local to the global, and then, Tony, I'm going to ask you about Kony 2012 and weather. I mean, you, I'm sure, at Al Jazeera, I know in my time at the World Service of the BBC, we covered the Lord's Resistance Army constantly. No one ever seemed to notice very much, apart from in Africa, and then suddenly a group in California, based in California, puts out an online video, gets a bunch of celebs to tweet it about, and suddenly 100 million eyes watch a, 20-some-odd minute video about an militia group in Uganda. What's your thoughts on what that says about where journalism is today? Is that journalism?
Well, I think it's, as you suggest, I think in your question, it's a reminder how selective and narrow and episodic our understanding of all of society, certainly internationally, international affairs are. I mean, I think there have been different organizations, obviously. I think Jazeera has been one of them, that have covered that story, the story of Uganda, you know, in a multitude of ways. And then the question is, well, why, as you suggest, why all of a sudden did this video kind of capture attention, which has so many dimensions to it that are almost have nothing to do with Uganda. It's just the nature of the media. And, you know, I think there has been an effort on the part of a lot of serious news organizations to try to kind of figure that out, you know. And it's been, as we all know, it's had so many stages to it, you know, that I think if anything, it's something that's going to keep happening, you know. But I just think that it's a reminder to us all to be wary of it. Now, I mean, you know, to be naive, it would be wonderful if all of this interest in this video got translated not only through news organizations, but in the public, you know, in a kind of enduring, continuing, building, growing interest in the state of affairs in Uganda and all of Africa. You know, in spite of my sunny disposition, I'm somewhat skeptical that's going to happen.
How did you see it, Judy, the whole...
I didn't see it as necessarily a comment on journalism. I think that the fact that certain things will go viral on YouTube, I mean, sometimes it's a bit mysterious. But I also think it's something about the way that journalists tell the story. Like, one of the things, when I watch Al Jazeera, I notice something, especially in the earlier days of Al Jazeera, is that... Al Jazeera English, because I don't speak Arabic, Al Jazeera doesn't just cover what people in power are doing. They also cover and talk to ordinary people, right? And I think that's a huge part of the success of Al Jazeera, that they do that. And they do that everywhere in the world, right? Mm-hmm. And the media here, and I think this may be true also of international coverage, tends to talk to people in power mostly, you know. So that's why you get even when we have more than 50% of the world journalists are women, sources are still around 18%, because who we're talking to, who journalists are talking to, are the people in power. And I think that what that video may have done, and I don't really understand it, I don't understand what made it so popular, besides the celebrity side, is just touch people's hearts in a way, right, that the journalistic coverage didn't. And so it's the whole thing.
What does that say about mainstream media, though? If we are incapable of producing the type of reportage that can move people in the way that the Kony 2012 video did.
Well, I think it's part of the framing of what news is. I think it's really a problem. And you know, I talk about that. Like I always say, the media turns to conflict like the sun, the flowers turn to the sun. So you want to talk about conflict, that's news. The only time that you can get into news when you're an advocate is when you're in conflict with people in power. We do the greatest stuff, you know, like build roof gardens and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Never get any news, but, you know, or the good, you know, I went on that march on the 22nd, and I'll tell you, there was so much joy and passion. It was just so fabulous. And I don't think there's anybody who could have gone on that march, unless they're ideologically completely opposed to it, and not felt this like a spring, like the printemps arabe. I love that. Anyway, And yet this doesn't get coverage. This, the beauty of that doesn't get coverage. But what gets coverage is when a few students go and smash up the minister's office. That's what's wrong with, that's one of the things wrong, I think. That we're always about anger and confrontation and polarization and not about the heart of a story. And I don't know that Coney thing. I don't, it's kind of was weird, right?
It was pretty significant.
But somehow it moved people. Right? Yeah. And a lot of videos, like, you know, all those cat videos and everything, I'm not going to go into that, but, you know, there's a way in which the media is too intellectual and doesn't have enough heart. I think that's true. I think that's a problem. And
Kittens on the evening news set, maybe.
You probably won't agree with that.
Moi, il me semble plutôt l'inverse, Judy. Il me semble que, justement, le storytelling est partout dans les médias aujourd'hui. Il faut toujours que l'histoire soit incarnée avec la petite fille à qui le malheur est arrivé, etc. Et je trouve que vraiment les médias, et je parle peut-être moins des médias de Montréal, mais partout à travers le Québec, où si on peut parler 50 fois par année du club Pee-wee de hockey, on va le mettre à la une du journal. Je trouve au contraire qu'on est dans une espèce d'information molle qui ne s'intéresse pas aux enjeux sociaux, qui ne s'intéresse pas aux enjeux politiques, qui nous parle de la vie, tu sais, de la... C'est ça, je parlais des sweet stories partout à travers le Québec. Et juste pour revenir sur votre tour du monde que vous faisiez tout à l'heure, moi je suis fascinée, je connais bien un bon nombre de pays africains, et chaque fois qu'on arrive en Afrique ou dans un pays en développement, on dit « il faut des journaux, il faut de l'information, il faut de la radio, il y a Hirondelle qui se met partout à faire de la radio dans les zones de guerre, etc. » Et puis on regarde le pays dans lequel on vit, on regarde le Québec d'aujourd'hui, en se demandant comment ça se fait que personne se rend compte que l'information, c'est pas juste le pilier de la démocratie, c'est le fondement du développement socio-économique. Si l'information ne circule pas, si les débats ne circulent pas, on va reculer et on laisse reculer des régions entières en ce moment. Alors, j'ai un peu de mal à comparer le Qatar avec le Témiscouata. Mais je suis sûre qu'il y a plus de fric au Qatar qu'il y en a au Témiscouata pour faire de l'information. Et je trouve que les enjeux sont vraiment pas les mêmes. Mais comment ça se fait qu'on porte pas le même regard sur notre propre société? Je suis fascinée.
Kai, I realize that you did, when you left CTV, write a considerable tract that a lot of people here will have read. But you do also use to tremendous effect online video in a sort of similar way that the Coney video with a lot fewer hits touches people. You obviously think that getting your message out there through the internet, through online video, and through, you know, speaking directly to the user, you obviously think that's effective in the type of journalism that you are doing. So what do you think of, you know, where do you draw the line between writing something considered and producing something that you realize will reach a much broader audience?
Well, I think it's important to try to do a blend, but I will note about the Coney video that the experts that just popped out of the woodwork afterwards explaining exactly why it obviously went viral. I mean, it's got all these characteristics, and anyone can see this is how you make a viral video. None of them have ever turned lead into gold. And if you could bottle that alchemy, whether those guys lucked into it or whether they had some insights about how to move their message, they deserve a certain degree of respect, diminished somewhat by the public masturbation and all the screaming afterwards, but they deserve a certain amount of respect for understanding how to move a message. And that is something that you don't learn in journalism school. That's something that you don't necessarily learn in the field as a street hard news journalist day after day. You rely on the mechanism or the machinery to move your message. And so one reason, Mike, that I have an interest in experimenting with these free video publishing platforms is that I'm very much interested in looking at rates of efficiency and thinking about basically ratios between effort and money expended and the number of people that you can reach. And so there are some sort of soft factors that are more difficult to evaluate, but there's also some common characteristics that you can observe across a lot of the videos that have been successful, and one of them is that they have a story. If you look at the top 10 videos on I might have to crowdsource this statistic, but I believe that out of the last year of YouTube videos, the top 10, seven of them were scripted and had writers that planned and implemented these incredibly successful videos, whether they're music videos or skits or advertisement. It's not quite as random as it appears, and that storytelling is still clearly very important. So, I don't know, if any of us had the answer to how to make a viral video, we wouldn't be sitting here, right? We'd be
making viral videos.
Flying on golden jets. But
je voudrais juste ajouter, si on parle d'Internet, qu'au Québec, 500 000 de personnes n'ont pas accès à Internet haute vitesse.
Mm-hmm.
Pas parce qu'ils n'ont pas les moyens de l'acheter, parce que ce n'est pas rendu chez eux.
Mm-hmm.
Et ça, c'est sans compter le nombre encore plus élevé de Québécois qui n'ont pas les moyens de l'acheter Internet. Parce qu'au Canada, en ce moment, et au Québec en particulier, parce qu'il y a des conglomérats qui ont fixé les tarifs, le Canada est maintenant un des pays de l'OCDE où c'est le plus cher. Il en coûte le plus cher par mois pour se brancher sur les services Internet. Je suis désolé d'éteindre votre enthousiasme.
That's a huge concern. And if you're trying to connect communities, especially rural communities, the people, as you point out, that are most affected by this drawdown, this pullback from the regions and the disappearance of local media, that's a huge concern, and that's something that I hope we get to talk about at this conference this weekend, because there is a policy matter to be discussed there, because clearly there's a market failure. There's no incentive to put those towers in. There's no incentive to build, to get 4G coverage in Clyde River, right? So I think that there's a role for Industry Canada to play, and I don't think we can view the telecom situation as separate from the journalistic problem at all. I think we need to start thinking about policy solutions for expanding, as you put it, high-speed internet access, deepening democracy, and diversifying the economy. I think there's a lot of actually really good arguments for getting those people coverage.
8:45. And with the traffic, no. 8:45, and what we're going to do, because we can't stay too much past 9:00. I'm going to ask you to start coming up to the microphones, if you could. I'm going to go around the table or along the table, but please approach the microphone. We'll come to you. I would like to seriously ask you for one minute on Dominique Payette, Les Compressions à Radio-Canada. Est-ce que c'est très sérieux, ou est-ce que, comme disait John Doyle, ça a peu d'importance? C'est un commentateur du Globe and Mail qui disait que, de toute façon, Radio-Canada ne fait plus l'excellence. One minute, seriously, all of you.
Je ne sais pas si Radio-Canada fait encore ou non l'excellence, mais je sais que c'est tout ce qu'on a. Comparer l'information de Radio-Canada, notamment encore de la radio de Radio-Canada, avec tout ce qu'on voit ou qu'on lit ailleurs, il reste que c'est encore, à mon avis, le standard. Plus on va fermer des postes de correspondants à l'étranger, comme on a déjà fermé le poste en Afrique l'année dernière ou il y a 2 ans, etc., ça réduit comme une peau de chagrin les capacités de produire. Et comme c'est finalement à peu près tout ce qui reste, je trouve que oui, c'est assez grave, contrairement à M. Doyle.
Assez grave. The standard Carnegata that brings in from Iowa consultants to tell how the Supper Hour News should do news, eyewitness news. Does it still matter? Does it matter? John Doyle's argument was, you know what, suck it up. Doesn't if you can't do something more significant than what you're doing now, then maybe it's time to move on to something else.
Well, I think a far greater concern in a couple of years than this particular round of cuts could be the loss of the NHL contract in 2013. I think it's just part of an overall wall of problems that is going to have a domino effect. So in the overall scheme of things, I guess I think it's so bad that one 10% cut is not disastrous on its own, but I think that it's the first domino, I guess.
That will happen. The NHL contract will not be kept by the CBC. It's gone.
That's been my understanding, and having just read Richard Sterzberg's book, which I will reluctantly recommend, it's pretty grim at the upper levels of management in terms of figuring out how to make this model sustainable. And unfortunately, I think I'm at 60 seconds, but Radio Canada is disproportionately funded relative to the population of its overall viewership. And so even the loss of CBC after Soirée du Hockey has already been gone will affect Radio Canada as well, and the overall corporation stands to stare deeply into the chasm over the next couple of years.
60 seconds on the CBC cuts. Tony Berman.
Yeah, and I'll keep my remarks restricted to the CBC, not Radio Canada, because I think there are two different worlds in this issue. I actually disagree with your interpretation of what John Doyle is saying. I think what John Doyle is saying is that the CBC basically is to a certain extent is the author of its own misfortune by commercializing to the extent that it has, by trivializing so much of its programming, by Americanizing so much of its programming, particularly its news programming, by ditching in awful, dramatic ways the coverage of the world. I mean, I've been off out of the CBC for 5 years. I can barely recognize the CBC's coverage of events outside of Canada compared to previous years. If you bring all of that together, what you're doing is you're giving Harper and his crowd license to do whatever it wants, you know. So I think by making the CBC marginal and irrelevant, and I'm talking about the CBC senior management of recent years, they sadly have made the work of the Conservatives far easier to do what I think ultimately is in the Conservative agenda to do.
Yeah, I agree 100% with Tony, but I also think, if I could say, I also think that the group Reimagine the CBC, which is saying we need a public broadcaster, it shouldn't look like the CBC looks, here's some ideas of how it should look. I think that's the way to defend public broadcasting, not by defending the CBC as it is. And I might point out that what was the radio show that they canceled was Dispatches. What was the, you know, they closed the foreign offices. So the present management of the CBC is doing the absolute wrong thing in what they're canceling. And that's the problem, is that you have this leadership which has just destroyed the television network almost entirely, I think, and is probably on the way to trying to do it with radio. So that's the problem we have. So we have to fight to change the CBC, I think. And I think Reimagine the CBC has been a really great initiative that way.
Je pense qu'il faut quand même rappeler que ça fait 30 ans qu'on coupe Radio-Canada CBC. Et donc la part de publicité augmente à Radio-Canada CBC depuis 30 ans. Augmenter la publicité, ça veut dire faire énormément de compromis. Et ces compromis-là, c'est ceux qu'on reproche aujourd'hui à Radio-Canada CBC d'avoir fait. Autrement dit, c'est un catch-22. Ils ont été coupés pendant 30 ans, ils ressemblent maintenant de plus en plus au privé, parce que le privé, la part de publicité à Radio-Canada CBC est beaucoup plus importante qu'elle l'était il y a 30 ans. Et c'est maintenant aux publicitaires qui rendent des comptes plus qu'à la population canadienne. Alors, le problème, il n'est pas nouveau, mais là, il vient de s'accentuer d'une manière assez dramatique.
Thank you very much for lining up at the microphones, and I'll start over here. Can I ask you to keep your preamble down to the absolute minimum and do ask a question, and let us know who you'd like to start by answering.
It's a comment. Mon nom est Lise Millette, je suis journaliste à la presse canadienne à Montréal, qui pendant 93 ans était une coopérative et la seule agence de presse au Canada, mais depuis qu'on a un concurrent qui s'appelle QMI, on a dû changer le modèle commercial. Je vais m'en tenir à ça de manière très brève. En fait, quand on parle de stratégie pour le journalisme, le commentaire que je ferai, ce sera simplement de dire de quel journalisme parle-t-on. Et j'avoue que je ressens un certain malaise par rapport aux journalistes que l'on a actuellement, où on semble confondre de plus en plus le droit d'expression et le droit d'information. Et on le voit sur les réseaux sociaux lorsque des journalistes, par exemple, donnent leur opinion ouvertement et où on perd, comme journaliste, le devoir de réserve. Et ça nous amène à un autre débat qui est de savoir est-ce qu'on doit donc être objectif lorsqu'on est journaliste ou si on doit être transparent avec ce que l'on pense ou avec nos idées. Et lorsqu'on met de l'avant la transparence, bien, je pense qu'on perd jusqu'à un certain point, la mission fondamentale qui est d'informer le public, non pas comme un acteur social, mais comme un témoin de ce qui se passe. Alors, est-ce que le journaliste se transforme en activisme? Est-ce que, comme on le voit dans certains journaux, on l'a vu dans le Journal de Montréal, mais on le voit dans la presse aussi, où on est de plus en plus des vendeurs d'opinions et des vendeurs de chroniques qui donnent leur opinion et avec des coups de gueule, ou si on continue, et M. Sorajou le disait tout à l'heure, et Mme Payette aussi, si on continue d'investir dans une information qui est objective, et ce genre d'information est bien sûr la plus chère à produire parce qu'elle exige d'avoir des journalistes qui rapportent des nouvelles, et non pas qui rapportent des profits. Voilà. C'est un comment savoir qu'est-ce qu'on veut préserver et est-ce qu'on doit s'inquiéter justement de cette dérive de l'information vers une culture de l'opinion?
L'opinion, en fait, son grand avantage, c'est que ça coûte pas cher et que ça rapporte bien. C'est notamment ce qui fait, par exemple, qu'on a vidé les salles de nouvelles des stations de radio pour les remplacer par des animateurs grande gueule qui coûtent plus cher, mais qui rapportent plus en publicité que rapportait la salle des nouvelles. Donc, c'est très clair que le courant qui va vers l'opinion et l'expression, moi, j'appelle ça le « moi, je pense que », il s'est énormément répandu depuis 10 ou 15 ans. L'ennui, c'est qu'il y a de moins en moins de joueurs pour produire des nouvelles qui vont permettre à toutes ces personnes-là de les commenter. Parce que, à beau vouloir commenter, il faut toujours bien qu'il y ait quelqu'un qui vous dise quoi commenter. Et on assiste vraiment à la réduction du nombre de nouvelles neuves. On a mené une enquête avec le Centre d'études sur les médias qui démontrait que dans les à Montréal, pendant 7 jours, comme une étude qui avait été faite aussi à Baltimore par le Pew Center, qui démontrait que la très grande majorité des nouvelles qui circulent pendant toute une journée est produite par les médias qu'on dit traditionnels. Et tous les autres font de l'agrégation de ces nouvelles-là. Le problème, c'est que ça ne donne pas un sou à ceux qui ont produit la nouvelle originale. Et l'ennui, c'est que si ça ne leur donne pas d'argent, ils ne voudront plus en faire non plus. Et voilà où on s'en va, à mon avis.
Yes. My name is David Pariser. I'm a professor here. I have a comment and a question, and in fact, my question kind of follows from the question that was previously raised. First of all, Ms. Rebic, I'm puzzled, I guess this was a deliberate little bait that you laid out there. I don't understand how it is a badge of honor not to wear a poppy. If you care to talk about that at all, that's fine with me. My question is as follows. And I guess this does relate to the notion of professionalism and the formation of professional journalists. If the end or the purpose of journalism is in fact to promote social change, what problem do you have, for example, with folks that are gung-ho for a certain kind of social change, namely the good people at Fox News? They believe in social change. It just doesn't happen to be something that is popular among certain people. So I would love to hear a discussion of effectively the question why the kind of social change that Fox News advocates is in fact not an example of social change. It is social change, just doesn't happen to be in the direction that some people want to move. Thank you.
Yeah, well, I think it should be my choice whether to wear a poppy, just like it should be my choice whether to wear a red square. That's the point I'm making. Not that it's a badge of honor not to wear a poppy, but that it's a position to wear a poppy, that you're supporting, you know, you're honoring the dead of the war, which is a point of view. You know, it's a position, just like wearing the red square is a position. That's all. That's my point. It should be a choice if I want to wear that. That's all.
What is wrong, if anything, with Fox News and...
Well, I find the question mystifying in that there you have every right to watch, applaud, weep at, do whatever you want with Fox News. I mean, no one is suggesting that it shouldn't be available. I think there probably are some people who disagree with its ideological or partisan bent, but I mean, I think the notion that it's part of the the media marketplace.
I will pick you up on that one, actually, because in Britain it would be impossible to have Fox News. It's in the law that you cannot have
an opinionated broadcast. Yeah, but we don't live in Britain, Mike.
No, but I'm saying that we live in a world where there are different societies that have decided that, in fact, there is a problem with Fox News and that they don't want to let it happen. So,
I guess what I'm getting at is that I mean, to me, bring it on. You know, I remember I was interviewed. I can't remember where. I can't even remember when. But before Sun News TV came on, I must have still been with the CBC. And I said, like, bring it on, because no one will watch it.
And no one
and
does.
And no one is watching it, you know. So, yeah. So in other words, I don't think that's the issue, you know. And I think I'm quite aware of the UK kind of issue about Sky and all of that. But I will say one thing, you know, that every survey, one of the great, I think, sad things of the U.S. is the low level of its knowledge of news and of world affairs, domestic affairs. Every survey indicates, in terms of viewers, that the least informed viewers in America are viewers to Fox News. And I think that says something about the level of information. Just to link it to the earlier comment, you know, I think my problem with Fox News is the only thing you get out of Fox News is an opinion, you know, of a certain kind. But you don't get the kind of information that allows you, the viewer, to kind of, you know, analyze and kind of internalize and create your own opinion. And I think the end result is that there are one hell of a lot of ignorant viewers of Fox News. God bless them.
Anyone else on Fox News? On Sun News, you were being attacked on Twitter by Ezra Levant.
I did start it.
Funding.
Okay, Tony and I have to fess up here. Ezra Levant got his start on our show, Face Off.
Oh, no.
Yes, he did. That's right.
Thanks,
Jim. He was a guest on Face Off.
I say no one watches Sun News television, and yet you were attacked. And then a week later, I think, in the federal budget, sure enough, there was this new policy about how much foreign funding comes to charities.
Yeah.
And so my question to you is could you address our questioner a moment ago about whether Fox News, well, is there anything inherently wrong with the type of journalism being done on Fox News and Sun News television?
Well, I think the definition of social change is something that's interesting to look at. And I guess my analysis is that the kind of social change advocated by Fox News is a kind of social change that benefits a tiny minority of the public, whereas the kinds of grassroots organizations that I think Judy is referring to, or the movements that she's been part of, are movements that purport at least to represent the plurality of citizens.
But Fox News has huge ratings, bigger ratings than any of the other all-news networks in the States.
Yeah, I'm not saying people don't enjoy celebrity worship, or for that matter, people don't idolize the extremely wealthy in the States. I think that it's a bit curious, it's a product of their culture, and it's very sad, but I think that the interests of the people, I guess, who watch those shows are short-term, but because of that lack of education, perhaps, it's hard to see the contradictions or the ways in which the policies advocated, in fact, shoot them in the foot.
Thank you very much for your question.
Hi, my name is Jonathan. First, I want to just say thank you for putting together this panel, and certainly Mr. Berman, I'm a big fan of Al Jazeera English, and I think probably like a lot of Canadians, I've reverted from CBC to Al Jazeera English online, especially from a younger generation. I don't have a TV at home. I don't have cable. I have a laptop, of course, and internet. So I think what Al Jazeera English has done in terms of embracing the use of technology to distribute its content should, I hope, inspire other institutions in Canada to do similar things. I work with a bunch of nonprofit organizations that work on something called open data. And I'm going to assume that most people in the crowd here are journalists or in the journalism world. And I'm keen to know, when I say open data or données ouvertes in French, how many people could comfortably come back to me and explain to me what that is?
Nous avons recommandé au gouvernement du Québec de devenir un gouvernement open data.
J'ai vu ça ce matin, puis on a retweeté. Je représente Québec ouvert et Montréal ouvert, et donc. So I'd just be curious to know, you know, also on the panel and in the crowd, who is comfortable with the word open data and would be able to explain it to me in like a few sentences, what it is. So, you know, I see maybe a dozen or so or maybe 15 hands up, and then to me that's kind of worrying. And I think it touches on the point that Mr. Nagata made about lowering the cost of producing news, or how many ears or how many eyes can you reach for every dollar spent, and not just reach on the Fox News way of opinion, but with actual real content. Mm-hmm. Al Jazeera embraced distribution through social media and through online, and open data and using technology. We've done work with the Gazette where we reverse engineer the city's budget, the city's contracts given to construction companies so that we can then find corruption. We did this for the Gazette, and then La Presse used it to write articles about Tony Arcuzzo, who was arrested this week.
Can I ask you for your question?
Yeah, sorry. So, especially Mr. Berman, how do you think you started at Al Jazeera English as a new organization? How can existing organizations change fast enough that they don't get killed by the conservatives, by the marketplace, using
well,
technology?
Well, I mean, that's such a vast question. But I think that the one interesting, and this, although I supported it at Al Jazeera, this was not my idea, but it is the policy of Al Jazeera, which is to make its content, all of its content, freely available to anybody, as long as when it is used accurately, faithful to its original purpose, and that Al Jazeera is credited. So that does mean that it's out there, and it's out there. And a lot of organizations, I think, would see that as a threat in a competitive way. I think Al Jazeera sees it, and I think this is more correct. Not only is it an extension of what it perceives as its public service, but I think it also is a way of extending its brand, so to speak. And I think that's what probably is an argument that a lot of other news organizations or companies should embrace, you know, that the clinging to the ownership of your material can in the end be a really self-defeating kind of process.
Your question.
Je pense aussi, juste pour ajouter sur le open data, que ce qui serait extrêmement important en ce moment pour raviver la profession de journaliste, ce serait que le gouvernement accède à deux revendications historiques des journalistes du Québec, qui sont la protection, le secret des sources journalistiques et l'accès à l'information, qui est de plus en plus difficile par le biais de la commission d'accès à l'information. Ce sont deux mesures relativement simples qui permettraient aussi aux journalistes d'avoir de meilleurs outils que ceux qu'ils ont actuellement.
Hi, my name is Hector Valletta Martinez. I'm a women's studies major here at Concordia University. I'm also the communications for the Women's Studies Student Association. We have been on strike since March 5th, and we are still on strike because we have a belief, and it's based on feminist research, that the tuition fee increase will have a negative effect on women, racialized, marginalized minorities, and as well as people with disabilities. This has not been talked about in the media. The media is talking about the striking students as a universal white middle class on their iPhone narrative without taking into consideration that there are people of racialized minority backgrounds on the picket lines, that there are people with disabilities on the picket lines, that there is a feminist movement that is supportive of the student strike. Within the university, the Simone de Beauvoir Institute has not opposed the students. Actually, it's the only department that has made explicit support to the students. The media is not talking about the feminist dynamic of the strike. The media is not talking about the racist implications that tuition hikes will have on society. The media isn't talking about the ableist implications that tuition hikes will have on society.
Your question.
And my question is, why isn't this happening? And you, as people of the media, can you bring about a change? Can you bring about this discussion about the racist, sexist, and ableist implications of tuition fees to the foreground?
Is there something you'd like to answer? A bit of kind.
Sure, yeah. I'm the least Caucasian person on this panel, I guess. And I can say that confidently, I can say that helped me in my TV career. The representation that we hew to online, or sorry, on the air, is defined in some organizations by a very rigid set of internal policies. In other organizations, it's more just a sort of case of standing back from the TV and saying, I think we're too white or we've got too many men on the air. But there's this balance that we adhere to that leaves the newsrooms in which we work even, shall we say, whiter and more middle class, once you promote all the people with exotic names and various shades of olive skin. So that, I'm sorry, is a little bit of a generalization, and it's a bit of a brutal thing to say, but when you look at the people who are taking journalism, the demographics, I guess, of the journalism programs don't reflect broader patterns, and that might have something to do with the problem as you see it.
Je peux ajouter quelque chose parce qu'il y a vraiment ce soir une différence qui m'apparaît très importante entre la couverture en français et la couverture en anglais. Personnellement, j'ai été convaincue par les débats dans les médias. C'est les médias qui m'ont convaincue que la hausse est extrêmement nocive, notamment pour les femmes, notamment pour les personnes des minorités visibles, et que ça allait promouvoir, au fond, les filières étudiantes les plus rentables. On va se retrouver avec une société de MBA, parce que pour eux, 33 000 $, ça vaut la peine de l'investir, mais ça ne vaut pas la peine de l'investir en philosophie ou en sémiologie ou en lettres ou en arts. Ce sont des arguments que j'ai entendus et lus et qui m'ont convaincue. Donc, je ne peux pas condamner la couverture de la presse francophone comme vous semblez le faire de la presse anglophone.
Did you want to say
that? I mean, I've been, you know, working on these issues for many years, and it's very, very hard to get the media to cover it. So for the fact that the two of the departments that are on strike in English universities are the women's, Simone de Beauvoir here, and the women's studies at McGill, and it's the only departments where the faculty is 100% in support of the students. That's a good story, you know? How come nobody's writing about it, right? As well as you point out, I mean, this is something that, it's a real problem, and I think this is a problem in both the Francophone and Anglophone media, is that while we might have people of color on the air, a lot of times they're trained in the same way. Like, can I tell a brief story? We had a problem of a neo-fascist group at Ryerson, and on the day of the International Day for the Elimination of Racism, the Ryersonian, a student produced newspaper, ran a cover story interview with a neo-fascist who had come onto campus to interview, to recruit. And I wrote an open letter. This was horrifying to every person of color on the campus. And I went into the classroom, and the people who had done the interview, one of them was the child of a Holocaust survivor, and one of them was Chinese-Canadian. And they both said to me, they eliminated their horror at this man from their story. So in other words, they went into that with what they thought was objective, which was the gaze of a white male, right? And they eliminated their own sense of outrage about this neo-Nazi and they put it on the front page of the newspaper, thus really harming the people of color on campus in a very serious way. It was a huge fight. And the whole journalism department, Tony wasn't there at the time, the whole journalism department, with the exception of one person, really went against me. Like, they sort of closed rank. So this problem is very real, which is even when there's more people of color or women, journalists, they're brought into a system which is very patriarchal and white-dominated and doesn't see, and that's the other thing I said, which is it's very focused on people in power, and it doesn't see the interests of ordinary people enough or tell the stories of ordinary people. I don't mean tell the stories like, what you call them, sweet stories? I mean, tell the real lives of ordinary people. And that's, and I think that problem exists, and we have at least somebody here who could tell the story about the women's studies. Not to put you on the spot or anything. your coverage has been very good, but there's a story you missed, and so did other people here. Because it's a really good story.
Well, we're going to take two final questions. We're already about 15 minutes over time, but I think we should have a shot at two final questions, and I'll ask you to keep the answers just a bit briefer, if you could.
Sorry.
Bonjour, permettez-moi de m'exprimer en anglais. I'm Ronald Robbie. Je pense aussi qu'on devrait honorer les Premières Nations pour être ici aujourd'hui. So I'm Ronald Robbie, an inspiring interviewer. Just about the student movement, when I read this morning that the minister of the government was quoted as saying that the student groups had to condemn the acts of violence before opening dialogue, I thought it was reminiscent of news headlines from Palestine and Israel. But my question is, I've been following the Guardian series about the, you know, internet men crying for help. And it makes me sleepless because it's kind of been a long way coming and now they're speaking out. So do you think that social media is really just a fun experiment that will die once government control takes over, if it's possible for government to control the internet?
Who'd like to have a go at that one?
Well, I mean, I tend to embrace the opening first principle. I can't remember whether it was Florian or Mark who said it, that anyone who tries to predict the future of all these things is unwise, and I'm many things, but on this issue, I'm not unwise. So I'm not going to predict it, but I will again, to go back to my the sun is still shining, I think the power of social media, the power of the internet, the incredible the connection that emerging technology is now making with people worldwide, I think ultimately will win out. I'm aware of the series and I'm kind of reading it, but it's one of these things that I've got to really kind of get into the zone on that, you know, in terms of, and I think if anything, if the series in The Guardian and I would imagine that it's probably quite brilliant, you know, foreshadows efforts by governments to do what you've indicated. I think that's not surprising, and I think it's incredibly public-spirited, as one would expect of The Guardian to do that. But I think in the end, I think the power of the internet and the people's and the popular kind of ownership of it now is will win out. That's my hope, if not prediction.
I think that one of the big concerns raised by the Guardian articles is that the huge social media sites like Facebook and Twitter, that they are the, you know, if once they start to get controlled and start to be controlling, we are so far down that road that we could be in big trouble in terms of the message.
I'll say very quickly that I think we need to keep evolving because clearly this technological shift came a little bit too fast for the likes of the people who are now trying to push SOPA and PIPA through or who are cracking down. But as Ai Weiwei, the Chinese dissident, says, it's hard to put toothpaste back into the tube. And he lives in China, so that gives me enormous optimism. Because they, if anybody's good at mass thought control and draconian telecom policy, China's a pretty good example. And even they have a hard time necessarily stopping people from organizing protests. And because the internet is organic in a way that no other system of communication so far, because it has a capacity for self-repair and for evolution, I think that as long as we can continue to support the people who are doing that work to push it to evolve, people who might be right now working on open source social networks that aren't owned by Facebook, aren't owned by Google, I think that's really our only or major source of inspiration and optimism. And I agree wholeheartedly that keeping the internet open, as Dr. Raboy put it, is probably the major battle of the next generation.
Last question of the evening.
Yes, hi, thank you. My name is Alexandre, and somewhat of a comment, but I'd like your reaction on it. And I've been quite perplexed by some typifications that have been done about, you know, journalism and the changes in opinion versus, you know, hard news and like the deterioration of the quality of journalism. And it seems to me that it comes down a lot to the values. But I mean, the values that the journalists themselves had, and that's kind of the thing that kind of rang out when there were the two first presentations where there were like journalists as pontificators and journalists as actors of social change. And right now, with the whole idea of objectivity, you have this loss. What I find quite interesting is that on the one hand, when you have opinion, it's kind of just je dis ce que je pense, but what has been lost and what seems to be coming out of the comments is the contextualization, you know? Just the fact that there was some people breaking stuff, or the fact that people were happy, 200,000 people in the street were happy of being there and that they felt, you know, enthralled to do more and to act out, that is not a sweet story because it could have political implications. But just saying it's nice and it doesn't count as news and it's essentially the equivalent of a peewee hockey game is completely misleading and is symptomatic of a disconnect between the journalists and the people, you know, they kind of supposedly represent. And it really resonates to me with this whole uproar when there was the public editor of the New York Times that said, you know, should we have journalists correcting politicians when they say falsehoods, you know? And everybody was like, of course you have to. The comments were so overwhelming, they had to close them. But then, you know, the New York Times kind of felt that they were in a hot seat. So they clearly stated that they were not really associated. I mean, he's independent. And we do have all the policies, you know, surrounding it to make sure that we make the best work ever. You know, you just don't know it and pay us for it, you know? But the whole uproar was kind of put between under the carpet and...
Your question.
Yes, so the question is, in essence, I mean, can this, do you recognize the existence of this disconnect? And do you think that a process, a deontological process, can actually mend it? Just the way of doing things, and it's not anymore about we share the same world? You know, this kind of...
C'est une question intéressante. Je dirais que il est très difficile aujourd'hui d'être un journaliste courageux. Il est beaucoup plus difficile aujourd'hui d'être un journaliste qui n'est pas courageux. Est-ce que le fait de reconnaître un statut professionnel à des journalistes va donner du courage à ceux qui n'en ont pas ? Non. Mais ça peut permettre à ceux qui ont du courage de l'exprimer sans avoir des enjeux aussi importants à rencontrer. Je vais vous raconter une petite histoire qui m'est arrivée en Gaspésie, où il y a un jeune journaliste très brillant, et je dois dire qu'en Gaspésie, il se passe des choses extraordinaires, qui m'a dit, moi, quand j'ai une bonne histoire, je suis obligé de la donner à un collègue. Pourquoi ? Parce que son employeur est incapable de prendre le risque de la plus petite poursuite légale. Et c'est ça aujourd'hui qui est devenu un enjeu aussi très important. Alors pourquoi est-ce qu'on se cantonne dans la petite histoire, moi j'appelle ça les sweet stories, c'est souvent des mauvaises mises en contexte, vous avez raison aussi, parce que les enjeux aujourd'hui sont devenus sur le plan économique extrêmement importants. Vous savez par exemple que les villes fusionnées du Québec ont maintenant beaucoup d'argent que la loi les oblige à verser à des avis légaux et juridiques à un journal une fois par an. Dans certaines municipalités, c'est l'équivalent de deux salaires de journalistes. Avec qui croyez-vous que les maires des villes ont envie de faire affaire? Avec le plus gentil des journaux autour de chez eux. Alors, ces pressions économiques font que on ne peut pas faire porter toute la responsabilité d'un mauvais journalisme sur le dos des journalistes. Je pense qu'il y a des conditions de production de la nouvelle qui, en ce moment, ne sont pas adéquates. Alors, le statut de journaliste, en fait, ce qu'il nous aurait permis, c'est de dégager le journaliste des pressions en disant, si jamais vous avez 25 ans, que vous êtes confronté à un directeur d'un petit hebdo qui vous dit « va couvrir l'ouverture de la station SO au coin de la rue parce qu'ils viennent de m'acheter une page », si vous êtes capable de lui dire « si je fais ça, peut-être que je perds ma carte. Si je perds ma carte, tu perds mon financement. Si tu perds mon financement, peut-être que tu vas être dans la misère par rapport à ton concurrent. » En fait, c'est ça. Ce qu'on voulait faire, c'était redonner. Et c'est sûr que ce n'était pas pour les journalistes qui ont des conventions collectives épaisses comme ça, qui sont assis dessus. Ce n'était pas fait pour eux, ce statut-là. C'était fait pour tous ceux qui n'ont rien et qui sont en ce moment non seulement la majorité des journalistes du Québec, mais la tendance la plus lourde maintenant, c'est en plus chez les pigistes. Et les pigistes, ils ne sont même pas capables de négocier un contrat collectif avec les entreprises de presse, et ils gagnent moins aujourd'hui qu'ils gagnaient dans les années 80 pour un feuillet. Il est là, le problème, à mon avis, crucial, il est là. Et je ne peux pas reprocher à ces jeunes journalistes-là de ne pas avoir le courage qu'avaient les figures importantes des années 70 ou 80, qui bénéficiaient d'une extraordinaire protection, y compris de la part de la population. Et aujourd'hui, vous avez raison, la population et les journalistes sont déconnectés, et il va falloir trouver une façon que les journalistes retrouvent à chercher leur appui aussi dans la population.
Yeah, I think you put your finger on something very important. And when we started Rabble, we called it Rabble for a reason, which was that we said our name is our mission, because the mainstream media, it's not that they're right or left, it's that they see the world from the perspective of the elites. That's what they're reporting, from the perspective of the elites, particularly politically and economically, you know, which is why we have these huge business sections and we don't have any more labor reporters, right, for one way that it's gone. So I think you put your finger on something important, but I guess I want to go back to the thing about news and opinion. Because I don't think there's such a thing as objective. I think we all see the world from a particular perspective. And so the question is the difference between opinion, like I'm an opinion journalist. I've never been a reporter. The only time I've ever been a reporter was at Quebec City, on the streets of Quebec City, for Rabble and the anti-FTAA. Thing. And what I tried to do there was report what I saw. And what the skill of journalism is to report multiple perspectives of what's happening. Because you don't, you know, you can, if you're in a conflictual situation or a dramatic situation, you can ask 10 people and they all will have seen it differently. And that's the job of a journalist, is to ask the 10 people and then to write about what happened, because the closest we can come to the truth, I think, is to write from multiple perspectives. And more, the media doesn't do that. It's writing from on high. It's writing from the perspectives of the elites. And I think that's why people are so alienated from the mainstream media. So I think you put your finger on something very important.
Juste pour ajouter à Judy, quand j'enseigne le journalisme, je dis à mes étudiants, ne me dis pas ce que tu crois, mais dis-moi ce que tu as compris. Et c'est la différence, à mon avis, entre construire et ajouter une plus-value journalistique et simplement me donner une opinion qui est fondée sur des croyances ou des a priori ou des préjugés. Donc, le « dis-moi ce que tu as compris », c'est ça le journalisme. C'est pas « dis-moi ce que tu crois ».
I think the value of journalism in its noblest form is to help people better understand their society and better enable them to help them control their society in whatever way they choose. And I think we can do that. Journalism can do that in a variety of ways. I think opinion, providing opinion, I think is only one way. I think of anything, and I think a incredibly important other way is to provide information. And it's not so much hard news versus opinion. It's information, in many cases, versus opinion. And when I say information, I'm echoing Judy's final point, which is it's the classic role of a journalist to, on behalf of their audience, to observe and to try to make sense of what is happening in front of them being the journalist. And inevitably, it has to be done through multiple sources, because we're all a prisoner of the shades that affect our vision. But I think it's important that kind of journalism is protected and is sustained. And I think that's the kind of journalism that actually is threatened. And again, it's the business model idea. It's because it's costly. It involves bureaus. It involves reporters on the street. It involves, when you deal with multiple sources, it involves clashing as to, well, what is reality? Opinion, in many ways, is very inexpensive. You provide well-presented opinion. You know, at the risk of belaboring the Fox example, I mean, that's what Fox provides, and they do it, and their business model is that you pay Bill O'Reilly 95% of the budget of his program, and you don't worry about bureaus. You don't worry about having people covering Uganda, God forbid, where is that, or covering the incredible developments that are occurring in Latin America. But the end result, as these cuts ripple through news organizations, the examples we've talked about, CBC, Radio Canada, BBC, it's incredible. I mean, one of the hidden secrets of international journalism, when I was with Jazeera, not so much in the Middle East but in Washington, was the number of bureaus the BBC was closing. Like, Al Jazeera now has more Latin American bureaus than any other international news organization, including more than the BBC. And it's done quietly, but it's done. And I think the end result is that the audience, whether it's a reader or a viewer or a listener, doesn't have access to the trained eyes of experienced journalists who ideally, with multiple sources, can kind of park to as best as they can their own kind of personal biases. So what happens, I think, what we're heading into is a kind of an environment where opinion dominates. I write a column now for the weekly column for the Toronto Star on Saturdays on world affairs, and I'm encouraged. It's a point of view column. I'm encouraged to, you know, express a point of view. And I have, and it's a balancing act for me, because on certain issues, whether it's Syria, or whether it's Palestine, or whether it's the lunacy in the treatment of Iran, you know, the whole kind of nuclear issue, you know, I have strong opinions, but I also have this almost kind of, the DNA of me says, I've got to kind of put out information that at least allows my readers to understand why I got from here to there. But equally important, if they choose to disagree with my opinion, at least that they will hopefully in my column will get some information. But I think that's the tension between news / information versus opinion, I think, is a real central one that kind of not only speaks to the value and the purpose of journalism, but also speaks to, at the end of the day, you know, what kind of public value is our work, you know, going to turn out to be.
I'll say very quickly, just to follow on that point, that I think that the looking at the laws of physics, right? Nature abhors a vacuum, and so when information disappears, there is a vacuum, and it's filled very easily by opinion. And one of the reasons cited is because it's cheaper. So I think one of the things we need to think about is how to make information cheaper. And right now, our techniques for gathering information are enormously inefficient. But there are some interesting developments with the rise of the open data movement, and also with this notion of crowdsourcing, crowdfunding, and also crowdsourcing of information, because often many different people hold little parts of the puzzle, and they would be quite happy to give them to you if you had a mechanism to talk to them by. So what we might see journalists becoming is more synthesizers than pontificators, and hopefully that provides us with some sort of measure of just a way to deal with the rising costs of, well, everything involved with gathering information, fuel and access to info requests and maintenance and personnel and all of that. If we can find ways to be little digital octopi, that might yield some positive news.
There's been remarkably little attrition in the room, even though we're half an hour over time, and I think that's a tribute to our panelists and the quality of the discourse. Thank you very much, Tony Berman, Kai Nagata, Dominique Payet, and Julie Webbeck, and thank you very much for coming this evening.
Thank you, Mike, for keeping it not under schedule, but keeping it interesting. I just want to remind you all that we have another free public event tomorrow, international roundtable called Insights from Abroad. Donc une table ronde gratuite encore demain. Des idées venues d'ailleurs, des questions, donc une perspective internationale. And it's at 6 p.m. at the McGill Faculty Club. Et bien sûr, pour les participants inscrits, on se retrouve demain matin à 8 h, Thompson House Ballroom at McGill. Merci, bonsoir.